If you don't like what we tell you to believe in, we'll kill you.
TheRightStuff.biz.
So I'm here with Dr. Kevin McDonald. I've been looking forward to this show all week. We're going to hopefully do a nice in-depth show. We can talk about Dr. McDonald's work, and then maybe we'll relate some of that back to items, recent items in the news. So welcome, Dr. McDonald. Thank you for being here.
It's great being here, Mike.
All right, thanks a lot. So yeah, no, this is going to be great. I want to first start talking about, we'll start talking about your books and talk about your theories and what they say, what they don't say, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the responses to them and your responses to those responses. And I want to be clear with people kind of on what the theories say and what they don't say. I know there's some people have an idea of the Jewish question that goes beyond what's in your work, which is fine, but you wouldn't want them necessarily attributing things to you that aren't specifically in your work, even if they have a wider view of the question.
Correct.
And I have some ideas of my own that I would like to ask your opinion on once we get through this segment, that are based on my observations of Jewish behavior and Jewish, how Jews behave in the media and things like that. But first of all, we've got your first book, The People That Shall Dwell Alone. I'm going to have to get your autograph on all of these someday when we see each other again. The People That Shall Dwell Alone, which is, I believe, the fundamental theory of this book, correct me if I'm wrong, is how Jews create boundaries between themselves and other groups and how they enforce certain characteristics within that group for the kind of things that they want to select for, like intelligence, ethnocentrism, etc. Is that a good characterization of the thesis?
That's a very good characterization. Of course, I'm talking about Jews in traditional societies. I'm not really talking about the contemporary world where these community barriers are broken down. Mm. I mean, in traditional societies, you had a strong Jewish central governments that controlled all the Jews in that little area. Nowadays, of course, Jews can do what they want. They don't have to go to synagogue, but they still may have a very strong ethnic identity, or they may have a religious identity. So it's all very complicated now, but yeah, so the first book was about Jews in traditional societies and how they maintained themselves, but also what traits they were selecting for within the community. Intelligence, I think ethnocentrism was another one that was selected within the Jewish community. That is, Jews who were less ethnocentric just sort of fell by the way. They might marry someone outside the faith, or they would just not feel welcome in the Jewish community because they were not very smart, not very not really on page. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't pay their taxes. They wouldn't to the Jewish community. They wouldn't within the Jewish community, social prestige social status was extremely important. So if you were not that way, you really sort of felt unwanted. The synagogue services, the barons, the business barons would be in the front rows and the other ones in the back, and there'd be a very strong demarcations of status in a lot of Jewish communities. And so even now, there are certain synagogues where it costs a fortune to participate. Mm. Say no, holy days, whatever it is, and obviously poor Jews just don't feel welcome at a certain point.
Yeah, and I grew up in New Jersey, and I lived for 20 years in New York City, and I always interacted with Jews and was around a lot of Jews throughout my growing up and my development. And I observed things about their community, even in the secular liberal Jewish community, which was strong, very strong in New Jersey. And very wealthy, extremely wealthy people.
Yeah.
They selected, and you would hear them talking like, "Oh, my daughter, I want her to marry a lawyer or a doctor, or I'm not happy." This was a thing that was going on in their community. So clearly, there exists a strong selection pressure within them. Now, one of the things that tips people off a lot, we'll get into this, we'll talk about the other books as well, but the idea of the group evolutionary strategy is, now I'm a layman on this, so I'm just kind of interpreting it here, but my understanding of this question, and I saw your videos you've done with JF and some other people where you discuss this, JF is not a layman with this stuff. He is actually a PhD in biological sciences, so he knows what he's talking about. And so he's even said he's a little bit autistic on this point, and I've known other people. But my understanding of the idea of group evolutionary strategy is not so much that you're talking about a selection like at a gene level or a replicator level, which is what JF talks about. But you're talking about, and my point on this is, like, I think maybe the terminology gets in the way for some people. Because to me, it's sort of like self-evident that people can select with group pressures for the kinds of people they want reproducing in their own community. It's like if people can do that for dogs, which people, self-evident people have created dog breeds based on preferred traits, why can't we do it for people? It seems weird to suggest that that's a process that doesn't happen when it clearly does.
Yeah, his comments reflect the fact that group selection is still controversial in evolutionary biology. It shouldn't be, especially with I've never framed it in genetic terms.
Yeah,
I always in the first book, the first chapter was all about how you create a cultural group strategy that selects for certain traits, tells you how you can treat the outgroup, how you separate yourselves from the outgroup, like with kosher food and things like that. But it was all cultural. It's sort of like if you think of the analogy of something like in the military, where you have a battalion or something, and you enforce the fact that they're all on the same page. And if they're not, you're going to shoot them. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course, it wasn't quite like that. Sometimes it was like that in the Jewish community, where if you were not on page, I mean, there were severe penalties, not just to you, but to your family. So, you know, they could enforce these internal rules, and animals can't do that. We are able to do it because of our higher brain. It wasn't until the last chapter that I really talked about Jewish ethnocentrism from a genetic point of view. I think they're both important, but without the culture, without creating those barriers, you're not going to have that kind of group cohesion. Mm-hmm. And then in chapter 5 of the first book, I talk about selection between the groups. My view is that if you're going to have a group selection, you're going to have selection between groups. And so I show that the Jewish groups were had the highest rate of reproductive increase, beginning probably in the 18th century and through the 19th century in Europe. They were just incredibly prolific. Mm-hmm. You had this religious ideology. You got to have a lot of children, to the point that a lot of these Hasidic groups, they were impoverished because they were so. They had so many kids, and they'd overshot their economic niche. There just wasn't enough, room for more money lenders and more estate managers and more tavern owners and things like that. Which was their economic niche.
Yeah,
so that a lot of them were poor, and so that was. If you look at the Jews that came to America, a lot of them were impoverished. That was the main reason that they left. It wasn't anti-Semitism. Ridiculous. Andrew Joyce, for example, has really written a lot of great stuff on the myth of the pogroms over in Russia and the 1880s and stuff. So, it was all about economic benefits and the opportunities of America, and they've certainly taken advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. What role do you think that this sort of internal strategy played in the development of their occupying those particular economic niches? And this can also sort of start to touch on your second book here, Separation and Its Discontents, which is actually a study of Gentiles and Gentile reactions to Jewish behavior and things like money lending, usury, frankly, ripping people off, caring more about justice only within their community rather than a more global idea of justice. Like, justice is for Jews, we can rip off the goy, things like which is their attitudes that well documented attitudes that Jews have had. I mean, they don't like you talking about that because it's not a good look. But it's an attitude that can be well documented that many of them have had. It's even in some of their books, I believe. So, what role do you think that evolutionary strategy played in them occupying that particular niche, if you will?
Well, I think that is a very important aspect, is this sort of double moral standard that you mentioned there, the sort of in-group and out-group versus what I call your moral particularism as opposed to moral universalism. Think of what Western ethics has always been universalistic, like Kant's moral categorical imperative, and really Christian religious teaching. For the Jews, it was never that way. And you know, I just posted on Oxford Observer an article about Balzac, the French novelist, by Brenton Sanderson, who was a great writer, and I strongly recommend his writing. But he talked, you know, Balzac was talking about that Jews would just have this avarice, that they'd be willing to exploit Gentiles. And one of the things that really struck me in reading the Old Testament is that you can see this. You know, one of the things that historically was really true of Jews, commonly true, whether it's the Muslim or Christian world, that Jews would make alliances with the elites of these other societies, and they would be willing to just completely screw over the rest of the population and in collaboration with these elites. So they would, you know, they would get, you know, this ability to lend money in these various societies, or they would get the ability to collect taxes. And in those days, it wasn't like a set rate of taxes. You go around, and then the guy would come to your door and say, "I want this much for taxes," you know. And if they didn't pay, well, he had the power of law. And Jews were often protected by the king as a very special group. And Andrew Joyce has also talked a lot about this in the Middle Ages. They you know, would make sort of deals with whoever was in charge, whether the king or the duke or whatever's in charge of that territory. This is the deal we're going to have. You know, you protect us, and we'll give you certain benefits. We'll lend you money. We'll pay taxes on this, and so on. So, you know, as Andrew Joyce said, if you look at England, even now, the houses that are best preserved from the Middle Ages are these houses of Jews, because they were made out of stone and brick, and they were like fortresses because to protect themselves from the surrounding population. And they had no compunctions about exploiting these people. And so they were hated. And, you know, a lot of big part of the Magna Carta was dealing with Jewish usury. And it wasn't too long after that that Jews were expelled from England.
Yeah. And you know, this is something that they don't like talking about. And they kind of try to neuter these points ahead of time by calling them like historical tropes or classic tropes that are anti-Semitic, have led to things like the Holocaust and such. And, well, okay, I mean, fine, but that doesn't mean it's not true. I think that the argument that this is a historical trope doesn't mean it's false. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean it's true, sure, but ruling it out as false would be silly. It would be more important, I think, to investigate why is it. And one of the things you noted is that this animosity towards Jews for the same reasons is something that crosses the cultural, racial, linguistic, geographical, and time barriers. Yep. So across, we see a similar criticism across all those barriers for really thousands of years. And that's not something I think that you can just sort of brush under the rug and just say, oh, that's just tropes. Don't listen to that. It's like, well, there might be, it doesn't mean it's necessarily true, but come on now. Like, let's look into this and see where it comes from.
Exactly. One of the things that, you know, the ADL, I think, or one of their articles on me, that they said, well, we've heard this all before. Well, yeah, you have.
Yes.
Because it's happened before.
Yes.
And you know, in chapter two of my book, Separations to Get Discontents, is really my summary of what you were just saying, that it's been going on, the same criticisms over 2,000 years or more than that, because, you know, you saw anti-Semitism in the ancient world. in the Roman, you know, during the Republic in Alexandria, say in Egypt, where you had a Jewish community, and there were all these conflicts in the ancient world between Jews and other groups. But it's just, and it was over the same kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a sort of listing of the various criticisms that groups have made, and like for example, talking about loyalty, you know, that Jews are not as loyal to whatever society they're in as they are to the wider Jewish community. And in that case, now that's Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But I know in the state of Florida just passed a law. You can't criticize Jews for being disloyal, even individual Jews. And that's an amazing thing if you think about it, as if it's impossible for someone to have loyalties to different things.
I mean, well, yeah. I mean, one of the things I've noticed about Jewish responses to this stuff is they never make the argument. They simply try to categorically rule out
exactly
the talking point ahead of time and make it not a part of polite discourse, make it not available as a talking point that you can use without being ostracized. And that will lead directly into the theory in your final book on the Jewish question, which is A Culture of Critique, probably your most famous book, one that everyone knows about. This is the, I believe, the latest edition. You should probably update it with a response to Nathan Koffness in your intro, but that's up to you. But again, all this stuff is available on Barnes & Noble. Still, I know it's been banned from Amazon, which is probably due to Jewish group pressure on Amazon. And I think it's available on Barnes & Noble, and it's also available from the publisher. I'll put those links in the description when I publish this post. But I think that this leads up to the theory and culture of critique, and then once we get all the theories of the various books out of the way, we can talk about them all in like a holistic fashion, which is, now I'm going to state the theory, and you correct me if I get anything wrong. I believe the theory is that in response to some of this anti-Semitism that arose, that you document in the second book, in response to this, and particularly the experience of the Second World War and National Socialism, we're not going to get into issues of Holocaust revisionism or things like that. I know there's a lot of people that believe in that, and I'm fine with that, but we're not going to discuss that here. In response to this, these Jewish intellectual movements, many of which have been exiled from Europe, from Germany and Poland, came to the U.S. and developed these intellectual cliques that promoted various things that all had kind of a dual nature to them, one of which was an outward-facing sort of moral teaching they wanted Gentiles to learn, or intellectual or philosophical teaching they wanted white Gentiles particular to learn, and also contained a Jewish element which was internal and hidden, which is about protecting Jews from another backlash from Gentiles, particularly white Gentiles. And ultimately, these intellectual ideas, most of them associated with the left, but not necessarily totally associated with the left, lead to less sort of fitness among whites and more fitness among Jews, if this makes sense. I'm hoping I'm restating it well.
No, that's quite accurate. I think those themes are most apparent in the chapter on the Frankfurt School, where you had their whole intellectual output was, I mean, they wrote a book on the Enlightenment, and there they talked about anti-Semitism. You know, that anti-Semitism was just about jealousy. It was completely irrational and pathological. But then when it came to white people, their ethnocentrism was what was pathological. Mm-hmm. Any identification as a white person was a sign of psychiatric problems and a poor parent-child relationships when you're a kid and that sort of thing. And they've been incredibly influential. And what has happened really? If you look at the Jewish intellectual community, say in the 1930s and prior to World War II, it was really focused on Marxism and communism. Mm-hmm. And Jews had done very well in the Soviet Union after the Bolshevik Revolution. They became a dominant elite, really. They never had the absolute power, but they ran everything, basically, including the secret service, the gulags, and the whole, and really involved in a lot of the mass murders of the period. But then after World War II, they started to realize that this was not an analysis that could work in a lot of contexts. In particular, it hadn't worked in Germany, in National Socialist Germany, because in that case, the working class had voted for Hitler. Now, that was something that was completely against Orthodox Marxism.
Yeah.
You know? And so they had to, you know, come up with a different explanation for that. And, you know, they started, you know, they, you know, had the idea that American society was, you know, ultimately quite possibly going to go descend into the same pattern as what happened in Germany in the 1930s. And so it was, you know, it was seen as a white problem, a European problem, that these are actually, if you look at it ethnically, and they start that the whole revolution was to start thinking in ethnic terms,
mm-hmm.
that it was really about ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And so they pathologized white ethnocentrism and white identity, and without ever mentioning a Jewish identity as sort of, why isn't this the same kind of pathology? They never would even discuss it. But anyway, the point is that this is how the activist Jewish community then conceptualized the problem. And so you start to see, you know, all the educational systems in the schools directed at, you know, correcting what they saw as this problem of white ethnocentrism. And a lot of that ended up, of course, with Holocaust education. The real message of the Holocaust education, as it is framed, is that, you know, diversity is good, intolerance is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to, any opposition to immigration, migration, multiculturalism, all that is, you know, mm-hmm. to be hated away in the interest of some higher morality.
Yeah. One of the things I've noticed in recent years about the idea of hate speech, this is all why this stuff from hate speech and such like this comes from, and this idea of systemic racism and things like that as a critique that really ultimately, and now they say, oh, you know, black people can't be racist against white people. And
right.
they do this by redefining the word racism from just, you know, we don't like somebody because they're another race, or you hate somebody, or you have bad ideas about them because they're another race, to, like, it's a systemic problem. And this seems to be a way of isolating only whites as culprits in this, because only whites do things, quote-unquote, systemically, whereas blacks are generally more disorganized and don't have – they're not really system creators. So even if blacks hate white people, a lot of them do, and they'll say that they do, and even commit hate crimes against white people – because they're white. I mean, this happened recently. We had a case, a guy threw a guy onto the subway tracks in New York City last week, and then he said, I did it because the guy was white, and he's keeping black people down. And this is, you know, the city might charge him with a hate crime. I don't know. Occasionally they will, but it's certainly not going to be a story that is going to be promoted in the media. We had this.
I've heard of
it. Yeah, well, the one that they, it's happened before. Like, this has happened before. It happens frequently in New York because there's so much diversity there that these things happen. And the people, of course, least likely to commit a racially or culturally, ethnically motivated crime are whites. I mean, they really are the least likely to commit an act of violence against another group based on group identification. It's happened, of course, but it's in New York City, it's incredibly rare. And the reverse is much more likely, but it's never talked about because it's not. And of course, the excuse for this, when you bring this up, is, well, that's not sort of systemic. And I think that comes out of that way of thinking. I think that distinction that they make comes out of this way of thinking, coming, going back to the Frankfurt School, really.
Yeah. Okay. I just heard something about Mayor de Blasio. You know, these Jews have been attacked in New York City. You know, they're Orthodox, you know, city Jews,
yes.
in particular ways of dressing and everything, but there'd be an attack. Well, de Blasio goes on, oh, white supremacy.
It's not white people.
It wasn't white people. It was Latinos and black teenagers who were doing this.
Yes. And
but it's like white supremacy is like the all-purpose, you know, explanation for everything.
And of course, those attacks, the attacks, of course, they always are recording. Every year they find ways to record an increase. Like in 2017, they said, huge increase in anti-Semitic incidents, of course. Some people point out the ADL knows this. They won't change their stats, that a good portion of those were one prankster in Israel. one Jewish prankster in Israel that was pranking synagogues in America. And they maintain these on their list so that they can keep their list of anti-Semitic attacks high without offering any context, and then implicitly or explicitly blaming whites. And yes, in New York City, these anti-Semitic attacks are not being carried out by whites. They are being carried out by blacks and Latinos. And they are actually, there's a good history here that people should be aware of in the Crown Heights neighborhood of Brooklyn, which is a place where these Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews live, right next to a community of poor blacks. And those two communities have gone at each other. Literal riots, race riots between those two communities have happened. And in fact, you know, New York City, because of this, because of the animosity between these two communities, New York City was able to do race profiling and certain kind of racial policing that other cities were not allowed to do because of, you know, they were sort of given kind of a silent pass, like stop and frisk, and Giuliani came in, and then Mayor Bloomberg, who was Jewish, came in and maintained, despite being a very liberal Jew, he was a Republican, but he's very liberal in most of his viewpoints. He maintained this harsh policing method of Mayor Giuliani. And look, I was for that because it made the city a better place. It cleaned it up, it lowered crime, and the central parts of the city, the tourist areas and such, were cleaned up and made nice again, and things, the city did well. I'm not denying the city did well under Giuliani and Bloomberg, but my thought, and you know, you could say what you think, my thought was that part of the reason, this was partly a reaction to Crown Heights, that they were, now it's all gone out the window now. De Blasio, as a big left-wing guy, has all this stuff, oh, it's racist, it's white supremacist, so the sort of memory of that has faded, but the people in Crown Heights remember it. And look, in all honesty, some of those blacks in Crown Heights, while I wouldn't condone individual attacks, they have a gripe against the Jews in that neighborhood. Yeah. I mean, there was an incident where a Jew ran a red light and hit two black children. One of them died. One of them survived. I don't know if she is still alive. The two brother and sister riding their bikes were hit, killed. One killed immediately. And then when a Jewish ambulance service came, now that's something they want to cover up, but when the Jewish ambulance service came, it treated the driver and his passengers and told the black children to wait for the city ambulance service. Now, there's all kinds of excuses they made to cover for this. And then, in fact, they even then blamed the police, saying that the police told them to get the Jews out of the area because the blacks were gathering and wanted to beat them up or kill them or whatever. There's an angry crowd of blacks gathering, and the cops, this is what they said. They said, the cops told us to do this. And, you know, one of my partners is an EMT himself. And he's like, you would never do that. You have a critical patient. It doesn't matter if an angry mob is gathering. That's the police's job, to keep that mob at bay. And as a critical EMT, I have to treat the most critical patient. It's not a Jew that is walking around. It's not a Jew with a bump on his forehead. It's the black child under the car. And this led to the Crown Heights riots, which was, frankly, an anti-Jewish racial riot. And this is not something that is mentioned when you see these images of a black punching a Jewish person. Not to condone it, but it does add some context.
Yeah. I'd forgotten some of those details about the, you know, the fact that they didn't help these the black kids. That's an amazing detail and sort of Jewish ethics in a nutshell, right there.
Yeah, and they have tried to cover that up, and I've been called a conspiracy theorist for talking about it. But look, I have documentation of this on my side. You can go back and you can look at the news reporting from the time. You can even read about the incident where they acknowledge that the Jewish ambulance did not treat the black children, but they offer several different excuses for it when, you know, a medical professional, my friend Alex, is like, those excuses don't hold water for an EMT. Like, it's not how EMTs are supposed to behave. So the fact that they did it at all, you could say whatever their motivations might have been, but they did it. And they have had to acknowledge that they, in fact, did not treat the black children and did, in fact, evacuate the Jews rather than treat the black kids. But this is going back. And so these people in this neighborhood are still aware of this, and they are still aware. There's a movie called Defamation, actually done by a Jew, criticism of the ADL, where he goes to Crown Heights and he talks to blacks and he asks them some of their ideas about Jews. And this would actually be interesting in light of your second book, some of the ideas that they have. And they're not the brightest people, and a lot of them have conspiracy theories. They talk about Elders of Zion and things like that. But they do have an understanding that Jews are sort of untouchable, that they might get off light from the city government, but not if they go up against Jews. If that happens, the city government will come down on them very hard, which is probably different than their experience in dealing with other white people, with Gentile whites. Is that, like, if they bother Gentile whites, they will not get that kind of crackdown that they do get. Like, they will say, like, nobody will touch these Jews. They'll walk around, and I have seen it myself in you know, poor black neighborhoods. It might not be the safest. You will see Orthodox Jews walking around like they own the place, but apparently, you know, some of this anger has boiled up and resulted in some of these attacks recently.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, you know, as you are, you're much more familiar with the situation in New York City, but yeah, these Orthodox Jewish groups really, I do think, because they're so inwardly oriented, and because of this, that they have a very strong in-group, out-group ethic that was on display with the ambulance situation. And I'm sure that quite a few of the landlords in the black area are Jewish, and they,
well, all of them.
A lot of these Jewish landlords. I remember there was an article about you know, the issues that are a problem for the Jewish community, and one of them is the reputation of these landlords. If you look at the list, I mean, there are a lot of Jews on there, and they're just awful landlords.
That's the list of the 100 worst landlords in New York, and like I would say, a good 70% of them are easily identifiable Jewish names.
Yeah.
And the other funny thing is, honestly, the other names are not obviously white.
They're not WASP either.
Yeah, there's like only two or three easily identifiable white names on that whole list. The rest of them are ethnic, other kinds of ethnic names, like Hispanic names particularly. So yeah, it's an interesting list, and these are the kinds of things I think that this is kind of what the alt-right particularly has sort of specialized in bringing to the fore, trying to insert these kind of points into the conversation. Like, well, look, I mean, look at this list. Okay. This is not an accident. This is not just a coincidence. This is not something that we can just overlook. This is something that's vitally important to a discussion of social life. And here, this list of worst, shadiest landlords. It reveals a social truth. And frankly, this is not a social truth that the powers that be, heavily influenced by Jews, want out there, frankly.
Absolutely right. And you know, that's why I think we're seeing so much emphasis on censorship, much of an emphasis emanating from the Jewish community. A part of it is because of Israel being so, sort of a, you know, international, pariah now, because Israel is departing radically from the sort of liberal leftist ideas that dominate Western countries, that we're seeing, you know, their way of dealing with these things is to either to basically ignore them. But what they're not going to do is engage in a public debate or sort of empirical, fact-oriented debate. So either ignore them or force them to shut up. And if they can't, if ignoring them doesn't work, then they go for up the ante. And force is no stranger to the Jewish community. Jews have always relied on a force within the community. And they've been very open to exerting their interests via force, whether it's through some alliance with elites in the traditional world or any other way. And now we see them being really the main instigators for hate crime laws and now, you know, criticism about Israel laws and that sort of thing. I mean, what's happening in Florida is amazing. I can't believe it's going to survive constitutional scrutiny, where you literally cannot criticize Israel in the educational system. So you couldn't have a debate between the Palestinian and Israeli about the...
Yeah, that does seem to run right up against the First Amendment, which is not really something they're terribly concerned about. I would argue they don't value it at all. They see it more as a hurdle to be gotten over. To the extent they address it, they will never address it as a good faith concern of the of America. It's one of our traditions, and it's written into our highest law. And they don't care. They see it as a hurdle, a way for me to get around rather than something to just abide by. And I think this is one of the ways they see constraints put on them by Gentile society generally. These are not things we should respect and obey. These are impediments that we need to get around or go over or duck under or whatever we want to do. So they never engage in good faith with the rules of Gentile society. They're like, look, this is a problem for us. Now, free speech was a good thing for them. In some ways, but I mean, and I think if you look at Jewish attitudes towards free speech, generally they are supportive, but they look at it differently. So, for example, the U.S. used to have obscenity laws and things like pornography, openly showing sex or genitalia, things like that were forbidden. And this wasn't considered to be a free speech problem because the context of free speech is understood to be political. And in my opinion, you could tell me what you think. This principle was subverted, not just subverted, but directly inverted, turned inside out, such that all kinds of obscenity is now allowed because of the First Amendment. But political speech, which because the political speech is going to be happening on private platforms, is totally censored or totally controlled in a way that is acceptable, where we don't have the ability to discuss the issue. We don't have the ability to say, well, we don't want things like obscenity and pornography in our communities. The First Amendment really is about talking about politics, talking about public issues, not about just showing, you know, obscene sex acts and things like that. So I don't know what your opinion on that is.
Well, it's interesting to think about that. Well, 2 points, I guess. One is about the history of Jews and free speech and political speech in particular, because Jews were such a high percentage of the people brought up in front of these committees in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. The McCarthy Committee, the HUAC, the House Un-American Activities mm-hmm. Committee, and so on. And so at that time, Jews were all in favor of free speech. Mm-hmm. Free political speech, because it really was being targeted against Jews primarily. You know, mm-hmm. they had these laws that professors in the University of California, I think, had to sign loyalty oaths. Well, that was, you know, or a lot of them were members of the Communist Party or had been members of the Communist Party. And because that was absolutely mainstream in the Jewish community. People don't realize that. Because it's been sanitized, but you know, the Communist Party and far leftism was really mainstream in the Jewish community, and until fairly recently. So at that time they wanted free speech, but now with these private platforms, you know, like Twitter and so on, they are very much in favor of shutting that down. Mm-hmm. That political speech does not have a right. And of course, the question is, you know, that I think that would be something that really should be litigated to the Supreme Court, is whether these big private platforms that practically have a monopoly on public conversation these days, if they can be regulated according to the First Amendment, that they would be seen as public utilities, as a marketplace of ideas and so on. I don't know if that could happen. It would just be absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I think it would be, and I also think that we could talk about this for a second. I think there's extremely good reasons for all of this. One, and not just the availability of the platform for speech, but also the availability of monetary transactions, making some kind of, at least I think the government should have some kind of responsibility for every citizen to be able to do business in a legal manner if they want to, so that banks and the virtual monopoly on banking cannot enforce a political point of view on the public. I think that would be something that should be available. Or that these banks, which are, I mean, the idea that a bank is harmed or has some kind of personal interest in not serving someone because of their political views, because that person is unpopular or something, which is the excuse that they use, is absurd. Like, nobody cares who's, like, if you are a Chase Bank customer, you do not care if Chase Bank also has an account for Richard Spencer or something like that. That is just absurd, and like nobody would even think of that. It is just a total excuse. It doesn't hold any water for a reason for really shutting these people down simply because of what they say. Like, and it's a total exercise of power. I mean, money power is ultimate power, and it's a completely unfair exercise of power. And I actually think, in going back to what you talk about, the Middle Ages of Jewish alliances with elites and Jews making deals and having those deals with elites specifically be related to money and banking, I don't think that that's necessarily something that we've seen the end of. I mean, I think there's a very strong argument. I know it's not covered in your books, but there's a very strong argument that the monetary system of the United States is still run along these kind of lines. I mean, certainly we see an alliance between Jews and the elite in the United States. You know, the elite WASP families and then even marrying into them, like the Donald Trump's family marrying into a Jewish family as a direct strategy. If you read the book Kushner, Inc. by Vicki Ward, which I recommend, maybe you might be interested. It talks about how it was a direct strategy of the Kushner family to marry a wealthy and powerful Gentile family, which they did. They got in there. And of course, now they have access to the president. This is not so different. This is not so different than what you would have been talking about in the Middle Ages either. And we all know the heavy Jewish overrepresentation in high finance and banking and such, and the way the Federal Reserve System works, which is a system that lends money to banks, and then banks lend money to the public at increased interest rates over what the Fed gives them, and they make massive profits from that. Just throwing it out there, it's something that is worth studying. In I mean, a lot of people have this idea in their brains just from observation, but I think it's something worth studying in depth for somebody. It's a challenge maybe I'm throwing out there to somebody to do an in-depth study of this, an empirical study where we can prove it, so we don't just have to talk about it like, oh, Jews running the money system, oh, conspiracy theory, right?
Yeah, well, that is something that I have not – I'm not really good at in financial – I don't really have a background in that, but it's well known that Jews have a very strong representation on Wall Street.
Yeah.
Since at least the 1980s, and that there was a sort of changing of the guard in the 1980s from the old WASPish white shoe firms that the Jews really a huge upward trajectory at that time.
Yeah.
A very important historical development. But, it parallels others, like in the academic world in the 1960s and thereafter, in other areas, getting to the high points, the power points of our culture, and really having a big influence.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that it goes further back than the 1980s, but it is what it is. But I mean, a good resource on this I would recommend is Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope. Although he doesn't specifically talk about Jews, if you look at the people he talks about and then look at their history, you find a strong Jewish overrepresentation amongst the financial elite that he does talk extensively about. He just never mentions their ethnicity. But you do see heavy overrepresentation. I mean, there's a point in one of the earlier chapters where he mentions the 12 most powerful bankers in Europe, and like 9 of them are Jewish. Yeah. And so it's something I think that is worth studying in depth, and I think it's something that is definitely relevant. And as we know, the money power is that will have a significant power over society generally and over the country generally. And I think this is something that we're seeing with the not just shutting down of free speech, but the shutting down of people's ability to make a living from speech. I mean, this is one of the main things that was with this latest round of YouTube censorships. One of the things they objected to was, hey, look, Steven Crowder, who's a conservative, kind of a blowhard. I think he's funny, but whatever. Like, some people don't. They're saying this guy was making fun of a gay guy, and he's making money. Of course, the guy he was making fun of also claims to be Jewish. At least I don't know for sure. But this guy Carlos Maza says on Twitter himself that he's Jewish, and he works for a Jewish media outlet, Vox, which is run by Ezra Klein, formerly of the New York Times. And most of the journalists working for Vox are Jewish. There's a few Gentiles in there. Most of them are Jewish, and it definitely gives a Jewish point of view. There was actually an interview on NPR with Ezra Klein where he effectively said, the white nationalists aren't wrong about Jews and immigration. It's just that we're doing this because we're such good people, where they say we're doing it because we're bad people. That was the essential, the essence. You actually tweeted that video out several months ago. I don't know if you remember it. NPR interview with Ezra Klein where he says this. But that's Vox. And so now Steven Crowder's ability to make money on YouTube has been taken away, specifically because of this altercation with this homosexual, because he made fun of homosexuals. And one of their things is like, look, you shouldn't be allowed to go on the internet, make fun of gay people, and make money from it. You just shouldn't be allowed to do that. And it's like, well, you know, by your, if we were to believe someone like Murray Rothbard or Milton Friedman, you know, Jewish economists in the libertarian tradition, hey, if the market demand is there, who are you to say no? You know, which is again, now here's a serious question I want to ask you. So one of the ways that Nathan Koffness attacks your work is by trying to show counterexamples of like non-left-wing Jews.
Right.
And I know this isn't covered in your thesis totally, but it's something I've developed as a bit of my own theory from observation. You can tell me what you think. Which is, it seems that Jewish advocacy, even of the right-wing variety, still serves a Jewish interest. Koffness would have us believe that Jewish advocacy of a right-wing variety is not necessarily in service to a Jewish interest by your theory. I don't think that's correct. I think your theory covers this. So you see a lot of libertarian and nominally right-wing economists, but we see how the arguments developed by these people are now used to stifle free speech that Jews don't like. It's quite remarkable. What do you think?
Right. What you don't have are Jewish intellectuals who are really behind white nationalism. That are just vanishing few. But I wrote a long chapter on the neoconservatives. About the fact that they're fundamentally, they share all the values of the mainstream Jewish community when it comes to social issues.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just that they're much more gung-ho, hawkish about Israel, about, you know, promoting Israel. And this is something that, you know, Jews in America, you know, and they see this basically two-party system, they don't want to be put all their eggs in the Democratic Party. And so have definitely tried to make, and made strong inroads, like some 20-some percent or maybe as much as 40% of the funding and the GOP comes from these wealthy Jews now. But they are all on the side of, you know, open borders and homosexual rights and all that stuff. And free trade, everything that, you know, that is sort of standard liberal kind of thing, the thinking in these days. But they are much more concerned to make sure that the support for Israel is bipartisan.
Yes.
What's got to be really, and the other thing you mentioned, libertarianism. Absolutely. I've written an essay on it, and I should probably republish that. I'm actually doing an updated version of Cultural Critique, and I'm including a lot of other writings, including my chapter on neoconservatism. But libertarianism is certainly compatible with Jewish interests.
Yeah.
A lot of people wanted me to write about Ayn Rand and objectivism because it really was a Jewish cult. I mean, all the people around her were Jewish. And you can easily see how, and one of the points, you know, it sort of surprised me at the time when I'm writing Cultural Critique about the Frankfurt School, is in the end, what they were recommending as a cure for white ethnocentrism was radical white individualism.
Yes.
That was really what they wanted. They wanted people to be free from every group, including their own families. I mean, that they were idolizing these white people who had rejected family ties, who had terrible relationships with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how they convoluted that and made it sound, tried to make it sound like, well, they use psychoanalysis. So if you had a successful white guy who was religious, say, they would say, well, the reason, you know, he's got this relationship with his parents where he's so afraid of them that he's imitating them or something like that.
Yeah.
Whereas, see, all these kids who are rejecting their parents and hating their parents, and they become rebellious against their parents, and oh yeah, those are wonderful kids, and they were encouraging rebellion against every traditional aspect of our culture, and at the same time, pathologizing successful white people who were enmeshed in their families, in the community, in the religion.
ironically, it's a critique that could be easily applied to Orthodox Jewish communities, but never is, where it's actually like not only the I mean, the Gentiles that you would apply this criticism to, it's certainly the authoritarianism is less intense than it would be. I mean, you could make such a critique of Orthodox Jewish communities. They literally are these insular things that you can't get out of if you want to. And, you know, this has led to this, and it's just something that they just don't talk about, like at all. And, you know, it's just really interesting. Yeah. I think libertarianism is highly relevant here. So one of the things that we talk about a lot is how they use, and this is possibly more relevant in America today. Maybe it's a newer strategy they've developed, how they use a dialectic framing to control discourse. So they, and that way they tell you what's inside and what's outside. And of course, criticism of Israel is only really allowed on the fringes on the left. Criticism of Jews as a group is not allowed at all. Criticism of groups generally is not allowed at all. And so both really, I guess you could frame it in terms of parties or trends, right and left in America today are essentially framed such that both of the main, narratives of each side of this debate are beneficial to Jews. And the things in each side that would be beneficial to white Gentiles and even not some non-white Gentiles that live in America are excluded. So one of the things I would say, like, look, on the left, you get multiculturalism, you get racial and sexual identity politics, you get mass immigration, you get money diverted to pay for AIDS money, you get money diverted to pay for immigrants. But you never get an effective national health system. You never get effective labor protections and union protections. You never get the increased wages that they want. And these are the kinds of things that people really want out of the left. I would argue many Gentile leftists, what they want is worker protections, better wages, better living standards, and not so much mass immigration and homosexuality. Whereas on the right, what people want more than free markets and once again, open immigration, unregulated capitalism, which is what we get, tax cuts for very wealthy people, etc. That's what we end up getting, and war and Zionism and such, you know, patriotism, which a lot of people like, has been shoehorned into a very pro-Zionist Israel first type position, very beneficial to Jews and all that. But what a lot of right wingers want is, less cultural degeneracy, more religion in public life, and less immigration. And they don't get those things. But they will get the unregulated capitalism. They will get the Zionism. So it's sort of like they've managed this debate between these two sides. And I would even argue that I have argued that the right wing in America, because the public media for the right wing, like Fox News and such, is much less. Like, there's fewer right wing magazines. There's only one right wing TV station. There's fewer websites, etc. It's more controlled by Jewish intellectuals than the left is. In fact, just in terms of the representation, the punditry, etc., it's overwhelmingly Jewish. Even though Jews themselves go like 70-30 Democrat Republican, the Republican punditry is overwhelmingly Jewish, and the framing, this, you see what I mean? How, I don't know if this is really covered by your theory. It's just something I've observed. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I think that these neoconservatives have been very influential. And so you have these sort of faux debates between on the op-ed page of the New York Times, I mean, between neocon types and you know, like Bret Stephens is a fiction. And he's a total neocon, and he calls himself a conservative. You got Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post; she calls herself a conservative.
Yeah,
Max Boot was also a Republican kind of guy, a neoconservative. Now he's actually calling himself a liberal
because
these
of Trump.
People are all they've never changed their real values. They were just saying, well, they did hated Trump because he was talking against he was immigration and that sort of thing. And I recall Wilhelm Marr, the German writer in the late 19th century, saying that both sides of our public debate on these issues are run by Jews, and you know, there's a lot of truth in that on a number of issues. It's anything with respect to Israel.
Well, Max Boot would fit right into your theory because he's a Jewish intellectual who openly says his viewpoints are informed by his Judaism, informed by what he claims is his experience with anti-Semitism in his childhood in Russia. Yeah. You know, we could be skeptical of that based on what we know about the history of the Soviet Union. Andrew Joyce would be better equipped to cover that than me. But his intellectual life has been explicitly advocating for Jewish interests. Now, not always saying they are. I guess I shouldn't say explicitly. Advocating for very Jewish interested politics. And not really covering his tracks on that too well. It's very obvious that he's a self-interested, very, very obviously self-interested Jew. Sometimes he even says it. He has said that his defection from the Republican Party over to the Democrats is specifically due to Trump and the echoes of Nazism that he sees in the Trump movement. This is a thing that a lot of Jews have reported, which led to a kind of frantic, even hysterical opposition to Trump in 2016. I think that not being unwilling to see Trump's total capitulation to Zionism, or being unwilling to be moved by that, seeing that, look, even though the guy has totally capitulated to Zionism, and there's a very powerful, influential Jew at his right hand at all times, and Jared Kushner, who's also deeply connected to his father, Charles Kushner, who's connected to wealthy Jewish real estate agents, who they even called them. Now, the Kushner family story is something very interesting you should look into. It's something called the Holocaust Builders, which is 9 wealthy Jewish real estate families in New York and New Jersey area, all of whom claim to be descended from Holocaust survivors. And they literally call themselves the Holocaust Builders. They called themselves this. and they were very influential and had a lot of dealings with Trump because of their existence in this real estate world in New York and New Jersey. And so the Kushners kind of put their eye on Trump, the Trump family, as a prize to be won, and they went out and they got it. Very much similar to Jewish strategies of intermarrying with elite Gentiles in the past. I mean, I would say it's directly the same thing.
It's been very common in the past, and it continues. I mean, Bill Clinton's daughter is married to a Jewish guy. There are other examples of that. It slipped my mind right now. But, yeah, I think it is something that when you have someone who's a prominent non-Jew, they will go after that to make a marriage alliance.
Yeah.
And there are obvious benefits to the Jewish
people. I mean, Donald Trump's grandchildren and his ultimate heirs of his $4 billion fortune are Jews now. So, yeah. I think he's got Gentile grandchildren as well. I believe one of his sons was married to a woman that was half Jewish. I don't quote me on that.
Sure. I've seen different accounts of that, but I think that.
But I mean, Ivanka, I believe she has 3 children, and they're all being raised Jewish. So not all of his heirs are Jews, but a good number of them will be. So mission accomplished, you know. And this is also in the Kushner Inc. book by Vicki Ward, which you should read. Charles Kushner, there's a discussion of a point where Charles Kushner asks another well-known Jew what his next step in his business career should be. And he said, well, you're going to want to buy a boutique property, like a well-known big property to put your name on, like a building in Manhattan, this Kushner-owned building, and you're going to want to marry Jared to a wealthy, elite Gentile woman. Literally said that. And then what do we know? They buy this building, 666 Fifth Avenue, which is a whole story unto itself, all the dealings and corruption surrounding that. And then Jared marries Ivanka Trump, one of like the this beautiful Gentile woman, wealthy family, total, you know, and this is a total up. This is the strategy is just so obvious. It almost doesn't even need mentioning how obvious their strategy is there.
Yeah. Yeah. I was amazed on Twitter that Bill Kristol the other day talked about his inner Jew as relevant to thinking about the war with was it Iran or Iraq or something. And my paper on neoconservatives, as I've always done throughout the culture critique, what I felt I had to do to really make a convincing case was to show that these people were motivated by the Jewish identity. Yes. This was important to them.
Yeah,
and that's the kind of thing when you see that from Kushner and their family and Max Boot and all, you know, so when I wrote about the neocons, you know, that's the whole thing. They're Jewish motivation, their Jewish connections as sort of critical to their self-image and what they're doing, you know, and the whole chapter on Jews and the left in Culture Critique is about Jewish identity. I mean, the idea is that these people were all you know, Marxists. They're supposed to be universalists. They're not supposed to care about about ethnic groups or something, but they did. And and their support for it waxed and waned depending on Jewish interests.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, that was the whole point of it. You have to show their identity.
Yeah, I've read, done a lot of reading on the history of Zionism and the history of Zionism from a Jewish perspective. And one of the things that is talked about is internal to the Jewish community, there would be an internal dialogue, which is not to say Jews are certainly not monolithic. I think it's important for everyone to understand it.
Right.
Jews are not monolithic. They can disagree with each other. But the point is that their disagreements tend to be, it's not 100%. You do have outliers like Gilad Atzmon and others, a few others, and they, Norman Finkelstein, you know, a few others that are just total outliers. It doesn't disprove a trend, as we know. Outliers don't disprove a trend. But generally speaking, these internal disagreements are about what is best for Jews. So one of the things I've been reading about, they talk about internal to the Jews, the new immigrants to America, you know, in the late 19th, early 20th century, was loyalty to communism or loyalty to Zionism.
Right.
This was a debate that they had, internal debate. And I would argue, you know, a possibility that that debate internal to Jews manifested outwardly in intellectuals allying themselves with this sort of new left movement or with the Soviet Union, with communism, and others allying themselves with ultimately what became neoconservatism. And I'll also add, one of the things about neoconservatism that's striking is it is not particularly socially conservative. And if it, to the extent it talks about these issues at all, you've seen these neoconservative intellectuals, particularly since Trump, like William Kristol is bitterly opposed to Trump, Max Boot, bitterly opposed to Trump. Despite Trump having, you know, other than his position on Syria, which was anomalous because I think it's something he developed on his own, kind of as a Gentile, he's looking at, Middle East conflicts. He's like, what are we doing? This doesn't make any sense. You know, just from a sort of pragmatic perspective, like this just doesn't make sense. We're wasting money. We're wasting lives. Or this region is a mess because of what we do. What the heck is going on? Now that he's president, well, he's getting talks from very powerful people about what is supposed to go on in the Middle East. And so, you know, this
Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, this Zionism, they then, despite their sort of what would be normally right wing, jingoistic, nationalistic, even foreign policy, they talk about the American flag and waving it, but then they all always revert to this. What America should be, and that what America should be is this vision of this egalitarian, multiracial society where distinctions between groups don't matter. It's all about adherence to the Constitution and values, and also best friends with Israel, you know. And it's a very unappealing. I mean, I find it extremely unappealing politically. I just don't, and it's a shame that they've sort of co-opted and I think perverted and undermined patriotism, because one of the reasons a lot of people don't want to be patriotic anymore is because it's associated so heavily with Zionism.
Yeah. I think what's happened is that, you know, after World War II, especially since the 1960s, I mean, there's been a sort of change in the whole value structure that we used to think of ourselves as a white Protestant Christian nation. I mean, I wasn't born Protestant, but I, you know, you really felt that this was, you know, this was a white country, a Western country, a European derived, and all of that. But you know, since then, we've got the idea of a proposition nation, open to anyone. Just, you know, what if you subscribe to democracy or something like that? And they've actually sort of interjected that into the past.
Yes.
Where they have the idea that we were always that way.
Yeah.
And that we are a nation of immigrants. Well, we decided we were not a nation of immigrants in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And that continued until 1965, is really a result of Jewish activism. But yet that is projected into the past, that this was always the case. We were always a proposition nation. We always had these values. We always valued ethnic diversity, even though at the same time they'll talk about, you know, races, the fundamental racist structure. But you know, that's the thing. I mean, they can sort of mold these, even change history to be sort of seen through a different, completely different lens.
I think this is one of the problems that they run into, though, because I think there is a limit on how much people will buy that. And I think particularly smarter people now are becoming more and more aware of this, that now you know, less intelligent people or people that are just average, everyday people, working class, middle class, they'll kind of just absorb the elite narratives, the things that they learned in school, some of the things that are on TV, and they'll just live their lives. Oh, this is just what our country values. Fine. We value diversity and blah, 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 whatever, right? And that's fine. That's how most people are going to be. So I think it's up to intellectuals to guide this conversation. And, right. and I feel right now it's being totally misguided. And there is this sort of fundamental contradiction of the narrative about America, which is it's always been a multiracial, open to everybody, but it's also always been a racist, white supremacist. This is because we're just not telling the truth. Right. Like, we should, and this is my fundamental complaint with Jewish intellectual dominance, is it's just not, we're not telling the truth. It's narrative to suit a purpose.
Yeah.
And every country is going to develop a mythos about itself. But in this case, we developed a mythos that's contrary to our interests as a, you know, now, not anymore a white European nation, but at the very least a majority. It should, you know, I think that there should, it is in the interest of the United States. Obviously, blacks will always be here, and they're not going anywhere. But it's in the interest to maintain a white majority and to maintain the basic value set. And that would be good for, and honestly, it is something people say, like, it would be good for the black population as well. But, I mean, they have suffered tremendously under the changes since the 60s. It has been terrible for them, the changes Absolutely. Since the 60s. So, you know, this is something that we should understand. I don't think we're ever going to get, like, 100% white North America. That's not really in the cards. But certainly a white dominant, white majority country was what we used to be and what we should be again, and is not an evil thing to be. And this topic, this point is totally excluded from the debate.
It just shows how effective they have been as gatekeepers into the media and the academic world as well. Yeah. That those voices have been absolutely shut out.
Yeah.
And and of course that is what's going on now with all the censorship. They're concerned that there's a huge leakage here, and they do not want to happen what happened in 2016, where Trump got elected. That is something that, you know, as you say, and I wrote a lot about it in 2016. You know, you saw all these accusations. Here comes the Nazi, and you saw the front page of the New York Daily News. You know, with Hitler, with Trump, and now they call him the Führer, you know, and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing that the hatred. And I think that is, you know, there's just so many, this mindset has been internalized by so many white people.
Yes.
It's just pathetic to see it. The hatred remains out there. And, you know, you and I are disappointed in Trump in a lot of ways. But for them, the hatred, the absolute visceral hatred that you see among people on the left is just a sight to behold. I mean,
it's psychotic almost. It's psychotic.
There's this woman that stabbed herself in the stomach yesterday. I saw on Twitter or someplace. Because she didn't want, you know, to live in a country with Trump anymore.
That's crazy. You know, I mean, I would.
She's psychotic. But you know, it's like this is a mindset that has been filtered down, and these people just eat it up, and they don't think about their own interests. Fascinating article in the Tablet yesterday. Yeah.
So I wanted to let me interrupt you for a second. We are up against the hour here, want to take a break and we'll come back, I wanted to get exactly to that article and talk about it and the implications. I also want to talk a little bit about the Trump thing, the rabid white liberal issue, and other things. Yeah. So let's take a quick break and we'll be back and we'll talk about that. So,
okay.
All right. Suicidal solidarity.
Two Swivel College girls from Canada are kidnapped in Ghana at gunpoint trying to help their African brothers. Australia's strict gun laws fail in a suspiciously dark area of Darwin. And some female bishop in Sweden says she has more in common with Muslims than with right-wing Christians. In cooperation with Graf Rudolph, this is Suicidal Solidarity. We start this week's episode with one of those sneaky black pills that may or may not have a silver lining. We're going to let you, the listener, decide. In Denmark's recent elections, patriotic parties suffered a considerable loss compared to their center-left and liberal parties. The Social Democrats took the lion's share of the election with 26% of the vote. which will give him 91 of the 179 seats in the Danish parliament. Comparison, the patriotic Danish People's Party went from 21% down to 8. That's pretty weak sauce. But before people start posting Danish Terminator 2 nuclear blast memes, there's indeed a whole white lining. It appears that the primary reason that the Social Democrats did so well is because they started taking a harder stance on immigration issues. So basically, they had to cuck to the right-wingers on their own immigration platform. I mean, it worked like a charm too, and we can expect other European countries that aren't total shit heaps already to start rolling out similar plans to deplatform their patriotic parties. That sounds bad. It's a classic case of an ice-cold, slimy kosher sandwich, but it's also the case of the Overton window shifting to our side. European political parties are going to have to stop being faggots about immigration if they want to win future elections, and if they go back on their promises, our boys will be there to pick up the slack. Donald Trump paid a visit to Cuck Island earlier this week, and oh boy, were those leftoids mad! Woke British Twitter was filled with the officially sanctioned corporate resistance, as were the dirty streets of Britain's bigger, more diverse cities. President Trump and Mayor Sadiq Khan got into a Twitter battle too, with Khan calling Trump a global threat. We guess he means to globo homo. And Trump calling Khan a stone-cold loser and dumb and incompetent. Trump may be a kiked boomer at this point, but as far as we're concerned, and to be honest, his locker room chat insults aimed at these people really drive him up the wall. Clown World Entertainment is still entertainment, fam. Liberal Democrat leader Vince Cable even had the gall to claim that British was actively working against British interests, which is 100% true if British interests mean the permanent deletion of the white British population and a skyline filled with giant metal dick shapes and rainbow flags, which it does. We don't even know anymore. The big gay Trump balloon is back too. Shit. That's what happens when women are not only involved in politics, but basically run them. Car Bomb Khan doesn't have much to be proud of as mayor of London these days. The first day of Trump's trip to Sadiq Khan's London was marked by 7 major incidents, including a shooting, multiple stabbings, and a knife man just taking a pleasant, menacing stroll through Gatwick Airport. Also, an elderly Trump supporter in London was physically attacked and pushed to the ground by Antifa. Now that's what we call brave resistance against fascism. The Remain crowd in Great Britain finally have an actual tangible reason to fight against Brexit. The UK's regulator for nursing has confirmed the number of nurses from outside Europe registering for the first time to work in Britain's National Health Service has surged by 126% in a year! As the numbers of non-white EU medical staff continue to decline in the face of Brexit. That's a total of 6,157 non-European newly registered nurses between March 2018 and March 2019. Gaze upon your future caregivers, white Britons. If you're lucky, they'll only be indifferent to your suffering and not causing it. Gaze upon them! Speaking of gaze, it's Faggot Appreciation Month, so everyone put on your leather chaps and lube up them orifices. Because we're going to have a fruit scoop for every episode in June. Funny enough, homosexuality is so rampant in the West these days that they just aren't really making the news anymore. The fruit roll-ups can literally dress as demons and expose themselves to toddlers, and it barely registers as a blip on the Western media radar. So we had to look far and wide to find anything worth writing about during this flaming week of Pride Month. And lo and behold, we are taking to the East. In India, Dutti Chand, India's first openly gay athlete, is facing a barrage of criticism from her family after announcing she was in a same-sex relationship. Yeah, it's a chick. We couldn't tell from the name either. Her parents ain't putting up with that shit, though. Her mom and dad have not accepted her daughter's wish to settle down with her partner, Mr. Chand, who would probably change his last name to Chad. Has called their relationship immoral and unethical, telling the Times of India,
"He has destroyed the reputation of our village."
We're sure the village's reputation was spotless before, for sure, and over in supposedly not gay China, Hong Kong's top court has ruled in favor of a gay civil servant applying for spousal and tax benefits for his husband in the latest victory for the city's LGBT community. Angus Lung, a local immigration officer, had legally married his husband Scott Adams in New Zealand in 2014. But back in Hong Kong, Mr. Adams was unable to access the benefits civil servant spouses are entitled to. It's just about Dem Gibbs, guy. Why are you so worried about the institution of marriage? This is the start of a trend of gay white people traveling to non-white countries and pushing for legal recognition of their sodomy, and the East Asian countries are going to succumb first. You heard it here. Except for maybe the Philippines, where Emperor Duterte will probably have them publicly impaled on their own sex toys in due time. Even based Judeo-Christian Israel has gotten their first openly homo minister. Amir Ohana, a member of Benny Netanyahu's Likud party and a big fan of cock and balls, was named as acting justice minister following the firing of the previous orifice holder. But here's the kicker. Mr. Ohana is a Netanyahu loyalist who backs efforts to protect Netanyahu from possible prosecution stemming from an investigation for alleged bribery and fraud. If we know anything about the Yids, then Israel will be allowed to become as gay and secularized Jews want, as long as the Yids at the top are protected from getting in trouble for anything and Israel remains Jewish. On the last note, the New Observer Online reports that Israel will relaunch its policy to expel all Africans pretending to be refugees from the Jewish state as soon as coalition talks on forming the country's new government have been finalized. Netanyahu's Likud party has told prospective coalition partners that they must support two bills, allowing the detention of immigrants for up to 3 years and enabling the forcible relocation of relatives to Palestinian attackers from their homes. It's a reminder that Israel has a literal concentration camp for African immigrants in the Negev Desert, which they should probably start calling the Negev Desert, to be honest. Our last story comes from the BBC WPWC and is entitled, "There is no word for Down syndrome in my language." So what language is it? What do you think? If you guessed Africa, you're basically right, because the answer is Swahili. The BBC WPWC thinks that this linguistic deficiency is caused by the condition being completely ignored in Tanzania. The subject of this humanoid interest piece, a young mother, writes that,
"It doesn't matter how educated you are, no one seems to know what it is."
Africans who speak Swahili have other words to describe their large four-headed brethren. Dumazi translates as dwarf. Tahira just means retard. And Nundanjakakakaka means zombie. I mean, those sound all right, to be frank. How the fuck are these J-leftists going to inject Western political correctness into an African language? We know your language isn't suited for most medical and technological terminology in the 21st century, but you're going to have to start using words that aren't so problematic, Kunta Kinte. That's going to go over real fucking well. That's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next week.
So, all right, welcome back. Right before break, we started talking about this article in Tablet Magazine by this guy, Zach Goldman, who's an interesting researcher that's come onto the scene recently. He's got a lot of interesting data, and he got this article in Tablet, and the data revolves around white attitudes, particularly white liberal attitudes, the sort of the new white left that he kind of documents is going back to roughly around the year 2000, when attitudes about race and ethnicity started dramatically shifting. And this is related to millennials coming of age, and some boomers maybe aging out and attitude shifting, and the radical shifts sort of since the 2000s. But then really since Trump has gone even more in that direction as a reaction to Trump. And the thing that Goldman kind of leaves out, it's interesting the way it's framed in Tablet, which is a Jewish publication kind of for Jews by Jews. So you always get when you read publications that are for Jews by Jews, you get a different take, a slightly different take, if you will, than what you'll get in sort of the mainstream press for the main population. So he's got a couple of takes, one of which is that white liberals have gone dramatically in an anti-white direction to the point where they openly identify with out-groups and disparage their own, which is not something that you necessarily would have seen from earlier liberals. This is concerning for Goldman, at least as he presents it in Tablet, because this also coincides with a dim view of Israel, seen as a sort of colonial oppressor state. Not without justification in some cases. I would say not without justification at all. I think Israel does terrible things. But then on top of that, The thing I think Zach Goldman leaves out is the role that these Jewish intellectual movements, as you have documented in Culture of Critique, likely played in the development of these attitudes amongst the liberal left among whites. So what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that that's correct. I think that what's happened is that the white liberals have internalized attitudes that are rampant in the Jewish community as, say, in-group, out-group, with respect to white, say, and non-white groups. In other words, Jews, you know, have strong in-group bias against whites, but that's because of their Jewish identity. But that has now been successfully propagandized to the wider, non-Jewish community. And one of the things that struck me about the article was his discussion of personality psychology. These liberals are nice people. Mm-hmm. One of the points I made in Culture Critique is that all these Jewish intellectual movements have framed these arguments in moral terms.
Yeah.
And so what's happened is that this is really disseminated now. And what they find is that white liberals are higher on the personality trait of what they call agreeableness, niceness. These are people who are going to, especially if they see someone being exploited or harmed, they're going to feel sorry for them and feel empathy. Empathy is very closely involved with that. And it's actually a part of my book that I'm coming out with on Western peoples, and the importance of personality. We are the most, well, I don't use the word agreeableness. I talk about warmth, affection, love, nurturance. We're the highest on this trait of any other group.
You have Richard documents.
Clinton, yeah. And what that does, it makes us susceptible to these moral arguments, mm-hmm. and feeling sorry for other people. And because we don't have strong ethnocentrism, if the person is suffering, we're going to feel empathy for them, whether or not they're in the same race or not, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so this has been internalized by these white liberals, and more so than conservatives, who are less so on that personality dimension. And so white liberals are prone to what I call pathological altruism, where they're not thinking of their own interests, especially in the long term.
Yeah.
What's going to happen here in 50 years? What's the world that they're going to leave to their grandchildren going to be like? Yeah. So that is, but yeah, I think it is interesting. And you know, how can they be surprised that Israel is now falling out of favor with liberals when the way they're treating the Palestinians? You essentially have an apartheid state dedicated to ethnic cleansing. They have these settlements on the West Bank, roads for Jews only, a totally, bifurcated legal system and everything else. And the government, you know, now Netanyahu is not seen as right wing enough or is it?
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing. So what's going on over there? So if you're a liberal, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance in the process.
Exactly. Yeah.
And and you can see that in the Labour Party in the UK. They have bailed on Israel. Jeremy Corbyn, of course, they're routinely accused of anti-Semitism. And, of course, they have a large Muslim percentage of their votes coming from there. So, the handwriting's on the wall for Jews that the left is not going to support Israel as it has in the past. And even now, several presidential candidates have not just been gung-ho pro-Israel, the Democratic candidates. They've sort of – Bernie Sanders among them. So I think that Tulsi Gabbard also is, you know, very much against these wars in the Middle East and that sort of thing.
Well, I think what happens on the Democratic presidential candidates is that they can no longer – well, they will be – the Clinton certainly very supportive of Israel. Hillary Clinton, total Zionist.
Yeah.
They will be supportive of Israel in office, much like, because, but their rhetoric on the campaign trail is more reflective, like with all politicians, rhetoric is more reflective of what they understand about what their audience, what their voters want, and what they do when they get into office if they aren't successful in getting policies that their voters, they're blaming on the other party. I mean, that's how it works, right? And, you know, Trump absolutely exploited sort of a hidden ethnocentrism among conservatives that is not talked about but lingers, and then didn't give them anything. You know, and this is similar things happen on the left. But, you know, so Joe Biden is going to be a Zionist president if he wins. But he's just not going to go out and advertise it because it's not really what his constituents want to hear. And that's a shift that they are. That's a shift that they are afraid of. And I don't know if you've seen this documentary called "The Lobby." It was put out by Al Jazeera. It's they did two of them. They did "The Lobby Britain," which is a lot about the stuff with the Labour Party, and they did "The Lobby U.S." It's 4 hours, but it's worth watching because it shows AIPAC, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, in action, and it shows them how they pressure and manipulate politicians and political activists in the U.S. on college campus, etc., to make sure that people stay in within a pro-Israel frame. And it also shows kind of an increasing desperation that they have, and it shows them losing battles on college campuses, but then, interestingly enough, through media manipulation, being able to spin those losses on the campus to media wins so that they can paint these campuses. And you see how this works. It's a brilliant strategy. You almost, when you see this working, have to give the devil their due, where they get these leftist students and arguably they've done this to the alt-right as well. They sort of provoke them to do things that are kind of like bad optics, and they show it in the media in a completely biased fashion without giving you any context of what's really going on. And they're like, look at these anti-Semitic Muslim sympathizers on this college campus, when that's not really what went on at all. But they do lose these fights on sort of on the ground level, and then they use their media power and their money power to kind of bring it back around to their interests. But they're very concerned with now. The Lobby came out in 2018, but it was filmed in 2015 and 2016 by a Jewish leftist that infiltrated these pro-Israel movements in America. And they filmed all this stuff, and they are very concerned about the left, particularly on campus, and the lack of sympathy for Israel, the lack of headway they can make amongst these students. And the thing that is upsetting to us about this is that I think it's good to have these skepticism towards Israel. It's combined with a sort of anti-whiteness. And one could almost argue that the anti-whiteness that is the prime motivator here, and the byproduct is them seeing Israel as a white colonial oppressor state. It's a conundrum that's not easy to work out, and not easy to kind of navigate your way out of this problem. Because I do think that criticism of Israel is very valid. I think it should be criticized, and I think their influence over the United States, their influence in these wars that we fight in the Middle East and are in our interest should be criticized, and their treatment of the Palestinians should be criticized as well. But I don't want that to coincide with self-hatred. And it seems that it does, and that's a problem for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the main problem with Israel for America is simply the conflict of interest regarding foreign policy. But certainly for liberals, you know, the way they're treating the Palestinians is absolutely abhorrent. I mean, it really is. The circle simply can't be squared any longer.
Right.
It's so obvious. You have to be just hiding under a rock not to notice this. The contradiction in sort of liberal rhetoric and attitudes. And I guess I'm not as cynical about Trump. I think that he has been, you know, it could be that. He really, you know, Sheldon Adelson is by far the biggest donor for him. He's put up, I think, $25 million in 2016 and more than that since. And so, there's an awful lot of money there. But I think Trump's been hemmed in by the so-called deep state on a lot of these things, like Syria. I think he wanted to get the troops out. I think he wanted to get the troops out of Afghanistan. But there's so much resistance. Mm-hmm. He's just been painted into a corner. He hasn't been able to do that, and I think that's his administration has been paralyzed, really. From the outside, there's this torrent of unrelenting hatred and criticism. I mean, you can't I get the emails from the Washington Post, you know, and you look at it, their stories. It's like one after the other, Trump hate.
It's not even news pretense. It's not even a pretense of objectivism.
Not even a pretense. It's a joke. But so this unrelenting hatred from the left, but then so many on the right, you know, not really on board. I mean, many on the right want immigration. Because, you know, they're allied with big business and they like cheap labor. They're libertarian or something. You know, they just don't resonate with the rhetoric that Trump was.
Well, there's a disconnect between the elites of the Republican Party and the voters. I mean, the largely white, working and middle class, culturally conservative voters. Who really are the ones that are getting screwed in all of this? Like they are not getting, you know, they're forced to endure the public celebrations of homosexuality, which they don't want to expose their children to. They're forced to endure their religion being really mocked and ridiculed throughout the media, which is definitely connected, in my opinion, to Jewish media influence. They are forced to endure the sort of the racial breakup of their communities, even if they don't understand that that's what's happening. It's definitely what's happening. I mean, you used to be able to have in the United States, there used to be racial covenants, communities where you were not supposed to sell your home to a non-white, and that's been rendered illegal. But that's just one thing. I mean, we're starting to see, and I think we're going to start to see in the U.S. Now, immigration to the U.S. has been different than Europe, where in 2014, Europe suffered just this massive influx, millions at a time. It was quite a shock, and it has led to a right-wing response in Europe that's very robust and is actually making big moves in Europe now, but can't really be defused. But in America, it was kind of like this slow boil. But now we're starting to see with the situation at the border since Trump and his inability to do anything, and I think he's given up. I think the inability to do anything has led to him just... He's just throwing up his hands. I can't do anything. And that's that. I mean, we don't need to argue about Trump. I think there's things he could do. Like, he could just tell the people what's going on. He could just call a press conference.
He could do more. And one example that comes to my mind is birthright citizenship, where he has talked about that.
Yes.
This is something that should be litigated. I know that if he does make an executive order on it, it will be litigated. They'll say it's
absolutely.
But... it's got to go through the
court. We got to have the fight. Let's have the fight. My thing is, like, a lot of people are like, well, that can't happen, that can't happen. I'm like, well, let's push those boundaries. Make them turn it down. Make it a public issue. Raise the awareness of the public to the issue. Get people talking about it. Get people on sides with wanting it. Republican voters were thrilled with the idea when he floated out. Now, you'll notice he floated the idea right before the election in 2018, right? Hasn't talked about it since. Literally, it was a story that was planted with Axios, which was given an exclusive interview with Trump in like a week before the 2018 elections. Axios reporter got exclusive interview with Trump where this was floated out. Trump kind of pretended like it was the reporter got to pretend like he'd broken his story. Trump kind of winked and nodded like, oh, you found me out. You knew about my secret plan. And we haven't heard a peep about it since then.
Right.
And so, forgive me for being cynical, you know, and on top of that, we had Lindsey Graham, who was one of Trump's main enemies in 2016 on a lot of this, on these neoconservative concerns in 2018 leading up to the election. Now he's all on board with Trump. And I think the Republican Party has absorbed Trumpism, as they call it now, as a successful electoral strategy. And they've kind of pivoted to this strategy of rather than fighting it, like with the Never Trump thing, which was not only unsuccessful, but was also exposing them as frankly, heavily Jewish influenced. I mean, Ben Shapiro, Max Boot, William Kristol, a lot of these neoconservative Jews were the fundamental makeup of this Never Trump movement. And it kind of was exposing them. One, it's failures because it wasn't winning the public. And two, as a Jewish movement. They have now sort of gotten the rebranding of the Trump Make America Great Again as a heavily neoconservative movement itself. And I just think that's a really bad development. And so I will continue to call this out. I think people should be aware of it, that we are really not getting what we want. And Trump could do more than he is. And I don't have much faith that he's going to anymore. He seems to have capitulated completely. You know, he could surprise me. I would praise Trump again if he would give us that executive order like he promised, but I don't expect it to. You know, a friend of mine said recently, like, you know, the Republican Party will become sort of a crypto white nationalist party the week before the election every year. It always happens. We've observed it time and again. And then right after the election, it's right back to libertarianism and neoconservatism. So that does seem to be it's
been a Republican playbook for a long time.
Yeah,
I remember there was a cartoon a long time ago with these abortion people, the anti-abortion crowd, and, you know, George Bush, you know, totally making that rhetoric. But then once the election's over, it's gone, you know, it's goodbye.
Yeah, and arguably they're doing this again with the abortion stuff, because it seems to me that the statutes, just upon cursory glance at them, won't pass. I mean, I don't think the Supreme Court, you know, the idea is that Roe versus Wade made the claim and set into legal precedent that an abortion is effectively a constitutional right. I find that absurd, but there it is, and that's a precedent that the courts have gone with for 40-plus years now. So I don't see that it's changing, and I, in fact, see these statutes most likely being struck down precisely on those grounds. But then, on top of that, this seems to be a good issue to throw out there for the 2020 election. It seems timed to coincide with the election and to be a fight to have. And I think it's a way of taking the immigration and the demographic issues off the table, because they did not like having those issues on the table in 2015, 2016. They did not like that at all.
It's definitely going to be an issue for a considerable percentage of Republican voters. I mean, especially when some of the Democratic candidates are willing to have, you know, abortion right up to the moment of birth and even after. It sounded like what the governor of Virginia was saying. And so it is something that naturally is going to be an appeal that is made by the Republicans. It's going to be a big thing. It depends on what candidate, because I think there's the differences among the different Democrats to some extent in how much they're willing to go, how far they're willing to go. But you can bet that it's going to be a big deal, that Trump and his advertisements and everything.
Well, when he gets abortion is an interesting topic, because abortion is actually is a winning issue for the left as well. It is an issue that will motivate them, and this has been shown with polling, and political sciences have shown this for a while, that it is an issue that will kind of motivate both sides. But I don't want to say it's an inconsequential issue. I think it is a very consequential issue, and I think we can trace, much like we can look at this left-wing anti-white feeling that is documented by Zach Goldman, you can bet that those people are also fervent believers in the right to an abortion. Like, I would almost guarantee it. I mean, because we know that people kind of political ideas like this, people often take them in sets. So you can easily predict someone's political idea. Like, if you know someone, oh, this guy's a big anti-racist, well, I'm going to bet you in favor of abortion as well. Like, it's 100%, you know. So it's very rare that you're going to get a difference. But so we know this. And I would argue that this, the way abortion is justified in the rhetoric is based on kind of this women's lib, women's right to her body, women's right to choose, which I would argue comes out of the second wave feminism, which is almost exclusively Jewish. I have yet to find an example of a second wave feminist ideologue, intellectual, that is not Jewish. There might be some, but I don't know of any that aren't. Now, of course, as you say, when you talk about Jewish intellectual movements, it's important to document that their Judaism is a relevant factor in their ideology, even if it's not always spoken about. So I don't know if you've done any research into the second wave feminist movement, like the Betty Friedan, the what's her name, the big fat one, what's her name, Dworkin. Susan, I believe was there. Susan Morgan was her name. Shulamit Firestone is another one. There's a lot of them, and they're all exclusively Jewish. Brown Miller is another one, another Jew. I don't know if you've done any research into this or if you have documentation of them talking about Jewish identity as being important to these feminist politics, but I suspect you could find it.
I suspect you could. I've never done that research, but
because it seems to follow the same kind of pattern as the other movement. The only one difference being it's exclusively female, it's exclusively women doing it. You know, Betty Friedan. Who's the other one? The one that was in Playboy slips my mind now. The most
Steinem?
Yes, Gloria Steinem. Yes, another one. I would argue though that these women exhibit very Jewish outward traits. Like they're kind of like yentas, if you know what I mean. They're like these. Yeah. These sort of talkative, really mouthy, aggressive women. There's a very Jewish archetype of a woman, of female personality in their community. So, you know, it's possible. But I think it is. I mean, my feeling is that the second wave feminist movement is a Jewish movement motivated by Jewish interests. And look at what it did. It had kind of an effect like what your theory would predict, where it took Gentile women and it made them less interested in family formation. It made them more interested in ideas of liberation. It talked about marriage as some kind of a prison. And oftentimes you would see Betty Friedan was a great example. She was happily married, living wealthy, living in a mansion with her husband in Long Island, and then telling white women, don't get married. Your husband is an oppressor. You know, I think it definitely follows this pattern. So what do you think?
That's an interesting observation. I hadn't realized that she was rich like that, but yeah, I think that you have to show that kind of thing. I mean, one, you know, I tweeted the other day about Paul Ehrlich. You know, he's Jewish,
yes.
And the author of Zero Population Growth in the 1970s. I was aware of him then, you know, and advocating, you know, don't have children, don't have, you know, most two children. So I do, and when I tweeted that, I guess Kaufness got on me,
yeah,
just because I tweeted it, even though I didn't claim that Ehrlich was doing it because he was of his Jewish motivations. I don't really know exactly where he comes from, but I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon that this has been going on. That, you know, sort of a tax on reproduction, really.
Yes.
But you know, the only people that take zero population growth seriously are middle class white people.
Yes,
obviously, this does not, you know. Black teenagers in the inner city are not thinking about that, okay?
No, they don't care about it at all.
They don't think about that. And the fact is that
nor do Mexican immigrants or Muslims or any of these people.
Yeah. It's this moral fervor of white populations, which, you know, is a theme of my book.
Yeah.
And we talked about, you know, in Zachary Goldberg's article, you know, these white liberals are moral to the core, and they're very motivated by moral values, the virtue signaling, you know, and wanting to present themselves as good people.
Yes.
And that's so they're just suckers for that kind of rhetoric, and they just don't think about their interests. And you know, they've been convinced, as you say, to not think of having a family and reproduction as something that's valuable.
And most people
really enjoy, and especially as they get older.
I would argue that they have not only been that on the fringes, not all of them. Some of these white liberals do actually have children, and some of them are reproductively successful. Despite maintaining these beliefs and sort of like what makes them happy. And they love their children. They're very kind to their children and they raise them very well, oftentimes in very traditional ways. Like they keep them away from the TV. They feed them good food. They don't let them have junk food. They make sure that they play in wholesome ways. So it's funny. I actually have experienced this in my own family. Very liberal members of my family have children and they raise them perfectly. You know, the dad is the one that goes to work.
Yeah.
You know, the mom, took some break time for the first couple of years of their life, made sure that she made all their food herself, made sure it was healthy, organic, wouldn't let them watch TV, wouldn't let them play video games, made sure they played in constructive ways, etc. It's very wholesome, traditional upbringing, but they're liberal to the core. Absolutely liberal to the core. It's amazing. It's an amazing phenomenon. And part of that is also income. They're very well-to-do income-wise, so they can kind of afford to have this, which is something working-class families, which have, if you read Charles Murray, devastated the white working class has been in the last half decade. If you read Coming Apart, very good book He talks about the devastation, the sort of separation of the, of class separation of the white community, which also would go along with, I would argue, this ideological separation. So these, it evokes a, I'll be honest on my part, you know, just my personal opinion, it evokes kind of a disdain for these people. It really, I don't like them. I find them to be, you know, hypocrites and moral virtue signalers, and just really, they kind of get under my skin. Part of what motivated me towards my politics is this sort of upper class. It really, and the funny thing is, you'll notice that people of color tend not to like them either. So there's this phenomenon they call allyship, of being a white ally. And there was a poll recently in this black magazine called The Root about, like, and of course they're allowed to have these kind of polls to begin with. Like, what's your least favorite kind of white people? And anti-racist whites were their least favorite. They can't stand them. Now, the fact that they're allowed to have that, they would publish this at all, is a symptom of a larger problem. But that they're sort of encouraged in these attitudes, where whites are discouraged in them. But I do think, going back to the second wave feminism thing and then the Paul Ehrlich thing, whether or not we can totally document all elements of your theory with these people, some of the elements are there in that they are Jewish. They're part of an intellectual movement, and that intellectual movement is promoting an ideology that is harmful to white Gentiles. Now, the one
by them is advancing Jewish interests.
Yeah, that's the only element that seems to be missing that we can't necessarily prove, but the rest are there, which I would think warrants further investigation to find out.
Yeah, I would agree in the case of because I haven't documented, say, with these feminists, I haven't documented with libertarians. But, you know, the other movements that I have dealt with, I have dealt with that issue specifically. When you see that many, a vast overrepresentation, and you know that they are, and you strongly suspect that there's a lot of ethnic networking going on, and mm-hmm. sort of, that they buddy up with each other, and they cite each other, and they mm-hmm. promote each other. That's the kind of thing that we see, that I saw over and over again in the culture critique. Very important. I think that the other aspect of this is white liberals, we talked a minute ago that they have negative attitudes towards their in-group, well, especially towards the working class. Mm-hmm. So many of them just really have dripping hatred for the white working class. They see that as not only morally superior to them, but as intellectually superior. You know, they're the toothless rubes, uneducated from the country. Just as depicted, you know, in the TV shows like All in the Family. I don't know if you're old enough to know that one, but from the 1970s, a classic, where, you know, Archie Bunker is this guy who's just making all his malapropisms, you know, and just stupid comments. And you know, he also was a little bit ethnocentric.
Yeah.
And
he was racist against black people. I mean, they didn't make bones about that. It wasn't necessarily he was pro-white, but he would say, he also made comments about Jews. I mean, the funny thing is they almost overplayed the hand there, because Archie Bunker became a very popular, beloved character. Like, people, when they look back on that show, they take, like, the white liberal son, Meathead, and they don't like him. It's Rob Reiner, of course, played by a very kind of smarmy Jewish guy. And you don't really like Rob Reiner. He's like fat and sloppy looking, and he's stupid too. And Archie calls him Meathead, and he's kind of like he's just not the kind of guy you like. And people hated Meathead, and they loved Archie. But the lessons of this show were directly the opposite of that. And Rob Reiner today, forget about it. That guy, he's still Meathead, in my opinion.
And Carol O'Connor, in an interview, though, he said something like, you know, I couldn't stand a lot of the lines I was being forced to say on that show. And as the show developed, you know, and this happens all the time, I think, when the Jews have a hit, like this was the Norman Lear's big hit, 70s, as it goes on, where there are sequels in the movies or later seasons, they get more and more political, and they orient more and more towards what they want. And in this case, you know, he ended up having a Jewish friend, going to business with a Jew, and all this stuff, and, you know, going to synagogue and having black, you know, it completely turned around from the early.
Yeah, and I remember there was a scene where he learned his lesson on race, where, like, because he had been kind of implicitly racist, but he would still be nice to black people. But then, like, they had black neighbors. He didn't want the neighbors moving in, but then he became friends with them, and then, like, they were threatened by the KKK, and Archie goes out to, like, fight the KKK.
There you go.
You know, it's like, it's kind of silly when reality, and look, let's be honest, it's the Archie character wasn't totally alien to people. I mean, there was a time in Queens when the show was set when you had kind of these white ethnic, like Italian, Greek, Polish, Irish people living in that neighborhood. That, one of the tragedies is that those neighborhoods, those ethnic neighborhoods, the white neighborhoods, with a lot of character have been cleansed. I mean, I'm from New York City. Those neighborhoods are ethnically cleansed. Those people have been moved out of that area. It's a real shame. But people like the Archie character. There's a funny scene where one time I remember he said, he's like, I was driving home and I got in a car accident and I need a Jew lawyer right away. You know, it was pretty funny, right? I don't know, but people did like it. So it's almost like, you know, when you look back, people like it because they're even in the fact that it was meant to teach you a lesson. You just don't get any kind of politically correct stuff like that anymore. And people, there is an appetite for it in some circles. So they look back with fondness on that character, which is sort of a funny thing. But yeah, no, I think your overall point is correct. And with the sort of the interplay and the influence of this these sort of Jewish intellectual movements on the sort of white, the sort of, I would say, aspirational upper middle class, status seeking white liberal population. Now, you talk about how they rate high on these scales of sociability or socialization, I would say. They're very socialized people. They've been adapted to the social environment. They know how to thrive in it. And part of how you thrive is repeating these things. Now, I know your theory of sort of pathological altruism has caused some controversy. I don't want to argue with you about it, but I want to posit this to you. Do you think that it's totally genuinely altruistic, or do you think a lot of it is about the virtue signaling and or do you separate those two ideas? Because one of the things I notice, which is the altruism goes out the window when it comes to white people. So if you take the case, a particular case is that of James Fields, the guy in Charlottesville with the car accident and whatnot. He ended up going to jail. He's going to be in jail for his life. Now, he was a guy who, according to some reports, mentally disabled, has autism, was kind of caught up in something above his head. This car accident happened. If you look at the behavior of this crowd prior to it happening, you know, people were throwing rocks and sticks at cars, attacking cars. His car was attacked with bats. This accident happened, and there was just no objectivity or sympathy for him in the situation. And they absolutely delighted in a really misanthropic way in the downfall of this young man who had just, in my opinion, was thrust into an unfortunate circumstance. That maybe is a controversial case, but in less controversial cases, the way they talk about Trump supporters, the way they talk about rednecks or you know, blue collar types, it seems that this altruism just, it goes out the window.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it's contextual. It depends on the situation. And of course, there's a lot of psychological benefits and reinforcements that go on here. But, you know, again, this trait of agreeableness, what I call love nurturance, does have a tendency to bleed over into others and to feel empathy for them, feel sorry for them. And at the extreme, we have, you know, there's clinical examples where they talk about the extremes of this case. These are the long suffering wives who, you know, deal with husbands who abuse them in various ways, and they just keep coming back for more. They seemed like they just really sacrificed their own interests for other people. To the point, but it is pathological. It's like off the map. When I talk about liberals, and I have a section on this in my book that's coming out, I emphasize the fact that there are an awful lot of reinforcements to this mindset and that are much more material. These are people that are not really thinking of their own long-term interests, but the virtue signaling is real. And, you think about it, I know one of the things close to home for me, because I was an academic, was, universities where virtue signaling is rife, and you can't get a position as an administrator, say, without really advertising this. But look at the salaries of these guys. They make more than regular professors. And if you get to the top or you're a university president, you can make over $1 million a year these days. So, it's really a game where you have to play by the rules, and virtue signaling is a huge part of what they expect in someone like that. So, there's a lot of incentives for this. I don't think pathological altruism motivated by extreme nurturance and love and affection is all that common. It really isn't. But what is common is that that the graph, in Goldberg's essay, shows is that these people do tend to be on that end of the personality dimension. They do probably feel some genuine empathy, but there's this attitude towards the white working class. I think it's especially true in the UK, where they just detest the white working class, and they're it's part of this sort of traditional class hatred that has gone on in the British society, really poisonous for centuries, really. They look down on these people as absolute, so the fact that immigration has hurt the white working class, they could care less.
There have been criticisms of this sort of elitism throughout British culture. I think even, Dickens made some criticisms of it. H.L. Mencken criticized it. I think even Oscar Wilde had some comments where they would talk about they care about the poor children like halfway around the world, but not the ones on the streets of London, because there was a point at which during the beginning of the Industrial Revolution when, the elite came in direct contact with the poor in a way they really hadn't before in the streets, because they were bringing people in the cities to work in the factories, and this resulted it was spilling out into the streets with orphans and things like that, and poor people begging, and so rich people, businessmen and such, they had to walk through this and see these people, and despite that, they're altruistic sentiments. Now, some of them did become concerned with this, and there were movements to try and deal with this. But a lot of them, the altruism was pointed outwards towards the children in another country, which became, there was criticisms of it. And it is an attitude that is this sort of caring about, and in a way one could, you can't prove it, but again, people get this feeling that this is not necessarily motivated by a genuine sympathy, but by appearing to be a really good person. I think there's a motivator in white cultures where appearances to be a really good person is very important, is linked to status.
One of the characters that has been written by an Oxford Observer site is Mrs. Jellyby from Dickens, where she was doing exactly that. He'd talk about her, looking to Africa and the suffering people there, and just completely ignoring what was all around her in London. And she wasn't rich, but she was, she was of the property owning class, I guess. But it was just this outward directed altruism. And of course, we see that, every time there's a disaster, like in Haiti, and of course, the media reinforces it. You will get your 15 minutes of fame for, adopting black children from those kind of areas. That is something. These same people having absolute contempt. And I think more and more, explicitly, they are seen as retrograde because they oppose this diversification. They oppose multiculturalism. They oppose, the people that bake the birthday, that wouldn't bake the birthday cake for the homosexual couple. They are seen as, get rid of those people in a heartbeat, and they don't care. The fact that they're their own race, their own people, and they're basically good people, good parents, and all that doesn't matter.
Well, I would argue this. I mean, I think that one of the things is that now along with incentives for that kind of behavior, there's disincentives for the opposite. So Absolutely. You know, this is one of the main issues on the alt-right that people have been having for a while is doxing. Like, what happens if I'm online out here saying things that are pro-white, but also saying things that are critical maybe of Jewish power, perhaps critical of black crime rates or Mexican immigration or things like this, and then I'm outed. You're going to have people call my employer. I'm going to lose my job. This is a powerful disincentive, really powerful, that is very difficult to overcome. And so you will get only the people that overcome it. It's as more and more people adopt these views, it becomes safer and safer. But at the beginning, it's almost completely. I mean, the fact that you can reliably get fired because you express these kind of ideas online, which I think is a disgrace, is a powerful disincentive. And I think, you know, this is one of the reasons why I think some of the ways some of our activism has focused not so much on, while it's important to talk about building a wall and stopping immigration and stuff, we should also focus on removing these kind of unfair barriers to speech, like the fact that you can get fired for political speech, like the fact that you can get your accounts banned, like the fact that you won't be able to use the financial system, you won't be able to access the economy. And you get the sense that they are aware that these are exactly the disincentives to these kind of politics that work, you know, the best.
Well, one example, of course, is Glenn Allen, who was fired from his position in the city of Baltimore, attorney for the city of Baltimore, as a result of activism by the Southern Poverty Law Center. No. He is suing them, and God be with him. I just hope that he can win that lawsuit. It would be a very important precedent.
Yes.
And the SPLC has definitely been overstepping their bounds, and their own image as moral paragons has certainly been tarnished.
It's been tarnished, yeah.
All kinds of things now. And the way they went about doxing him, the information they got, it seems to have been gotten illegally.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of issues about that, but it'd be great if you could turn the tables on some of these people and make that something that you could litigate.
I mean, there's efforts that are going into this because we've sort of identified this as a major weak point, whereas if we could get it so that people that and there are legal avenues to explore here, like it's not exactly legal to call someone's employer and try to break an employment contract for the sole purpose of harming the employee. Like there are things on the books that are essentially, it's not that it's a criminal thing, but that you could be liable to the person who you harm in that way. It's called tortious interference. Yeah, exactly. So it's not like there's not remedies for this, but we need to have lawyers willing to fight these fights. We need to have people willing to be a plaintiff in such a suit, because people will then worry, well, look, I lost this one job, but the employer is willing to just be quiet about it, so I'll get another one. And it won't follow me to my next job, and then they'll be okay. But if I'm a plaintiff in a suit like this, well, you know, so there's all these disincentives, and we're really working uphill here. But again, I think with moral support of the community, these things are starting to get worked out. And this is a fight. These are the fights we're going to be having. But I think it's
not a tactic they're going to give up anytime soon.
Well, if it works, I mean, it's effective.
And of course,
right?
You know, it's not just the Southern Poverty Law Center. You know, it'll come out in Vox or someplace.
Oh, yes. Like,
the other day there was an article in, was it Huffington Post, I guess, about all these Twitter accounts that are, you know.
I wouldn't know which Twitter accounts you're talking about.
And I'm sure you're on that list.
I was number one.
Yeah, exactly. So we were all on there, and who knows what will happen.
Finally, I'm number one in something.
Finally. All right. Congratulations.
But yes. But yeah, no, I mean, I think that it does take a certain kind of person to be willing to be the first into the fray on these kinds of things. And, you know, the first one into the fray always makes it easier for the people to follow. So it is important to fight these battles. But yeah, I think it's a parallel to, you know, there's rewards, there's social rewards. And we do find that the types of white people that get involved in this are the aspirational types. Like they want to ascend the social ladder. They want to be seen as high class, as important, as good people. And one of the antagonisms with alternate cultures is like, for example, the more working class and middle class oftentimes, sometimes even people with money, but the Christian culture, which does have its problems with Christian Zionism, etc. But generally speaking, it's like an alternate culture to this mainstream media and intellectual influence culture that is very pro-diversity, very anti-white, very pro-homosexual. It's an alt, and you can gain status within that alternate community. So I think it's very important as a sort of a competing status system for that to be denigrated. If you kind of get what I mean, like whites could theoretically get involved in that community, the very religious community, and they could gain status and the admiration of their peers and their neighbors by being seen as a good Christian. So it's like an alternate status system that it seemed like it was very important for this to be denigrated. And so you see them talking about how, oh, all these dumb rednecks are also Christian. They are very religious. And that gets denigrated in the media. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, absolutely. They don't want other systems of status around, really. They really want, you know, a sort of monoculture of the left, where the only media available comes from that. The only way to have any status within any interesting subgroup is to subscribe to those ideas. That's a big part of their activism.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that when we talked about that a lot, I wanted to give you some time to respond to Nathan Koffness. I know that you've done it. I know you wrote a paper about it. But it's been kind of the one paper where a guy, an academic from a big institution, Oxford in this case, came out. I know one of the points you've been making for years about your work is that, hey, like it's been denigrated, but it hasn't been adequately criticized. Like Steven Pinker brushed it off, a few others, and to the extent there were some academics that reviewed it, it wasn't satisfactory for a number of reasons. The introduction to your 2002 edition covers this pretty well, so people should read that. But then here comes Koffness. Interestingly enough, and just a few comments on Koffness. Now, he is a Jewish guy. He makes certain claims, generally speaking, not even just in addressing you, but about himself. He claims he's not particularly worried about Jewish identity. He's not particularly ethnocentric. But I think that's a suspicious claim, given that at a time when, post-Charlottesville, post-Trump, post the alt-right coming into being as a thing, with your book being cited in the media as being very influential for this new trend among young white men particularly, that all of a sudden he comes on the scene with a paper that is claiming to intellectually refute your work, but being very politically incorrect in other ways. So it's almost as if his work is specifically tailored to a community that is open to ideas about racial differences, that is open to ideas about genetic reasons for intelligence differences, HBD, and things like this, but is also open to your work. So he's not targeting it at white liberals. They are well walled off from being open to these ideas, if you will. Like, they are well taken care of in that way. But the new alt-right, some call it neo-reaction, other tendencies on sort of the dissident right, he's clearly, in my opinion, sort of directly appealing to them while trying to discredit you. It sort of seems like he's actually taking an ethnic strategy here. He's seeing a threat and he's trying to neutralize it. I could be wrong. This is my interpretation. And I simply don't believe him when he says he's not doing it for ethnic reasons, when his entire output is about policing this area.
Yeah, I don't believe him either. I really don't trust him as a person, actually. Because I can't believe that he really doesn't understand the argument of culture critique to the extent he seems to
miss the point.
And he keeps saying these things as if I never wrote a response. Typically what his claim will be, we sort of referred to before, well, there's Jews on both sides and it's just a matter of IQ and so on. But again, we don't see Jews overrepresented in really white ethnic nationalist movements. These different Jewish movements on different sides of it can be like arguing within the Jewish community.
Yeah.
like in the Israeli parliament, in the Knesset, about different policies that could benefit the Jews. And I think that that's a legitimate thing. Or it can be, you know, an attempt to influence both sides of the political spectrum in America, where you have a two-party system. So there's a lot of things. So I go into that all the time. I mean, show that that the Jewish new conservatives are just as identified as Jews, just as apt to see what they're doing in terms of Jewish interests, and you know, focusing more on Israel than the Jewish left, which is more concerned about diaspora issues, and you know, dealing with white America as sort of on the front burner, whereas for the neocons it's sort of in a little bit on the back burner, but it's there, and you can see that because they were the ones who were, you know, just fanatically opposed to Trump. They were the never Trumpers, and they still are. And it was all because they saw him as a forerunner of fascism. I mean, you could see Max.
They Boots openly said that. I mean,
all of them. They did say that. I wrote a bunch of articles for VDR during 2016. It was amazing, sort of the rhetoric that they had there.
Yeah, they were openly
end of the world. Hitler's coming, and we got So the fact that they have different political party affiliations, or call themselves conservatives, means absolutely nothing in terms of what they're, how they see whether their Jewish identity is important, and whether what they are involved in as a Jewish movement is influential. The other thing, he would bring up someone like Soros. Well, you know, he's kind of an anomaly in a lot of ways, but you know, there are individual Jews like Steven Pinker. He's influential, I guess. He's not a Jewish intellectual movement, but I do firmly believe he is. I'm not going to write about him just because. But you know, he's a good guy who also is very much like Kaufman's, by the way. You know, where who will say things. IQ is important, and Jews are specialized in IQ, and it's genetic, you know, and so there's a human bias, you know, the HBD crowd eats that up. But then, you know, he hates what I write because I'd say, well, they use this, you know, to develop these movements and have influence on public policy. That's not necessarily the interest of the other people around. And so he just rejects all of that.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, it doesn't actually make sense what he's saying. And JF did a great video, I don't know if you've seen it or not, critiquing Kaufness's. It's 3 hours, so it's a long video. He did it. You can't find it. He took it off YouTube because I think it butts up against their new rules they unveiled a couple of days ago. Uh-huh. But it's on BitChute. You can watch it. It's a great video. He does 3 hours. Now, it is long. But he goes and he reads all of the paper of Kaufness, and he talks about certain things. And one of the points he makes, which I thought was very good, is that Kaufness says there's this default view of the Jewish question, if you will, that kind of takes care of your theory. And he presents it as an alternative, but it's really doesn't contradict your theory at all, and in fact is one of the elements of your theory and can be incorporated into it. So he's like, well, Jews are traditionally, they're higher IQ and they're traditionally located in intellectual centers. So this explains the influence. I'm like, yeah, but that's not really in any way not jiving with your theory. It goes right along with it. It's like, well, they are higher IQ. And they are. Why are they higher IQ? And why are they located in influential urban centers? Like, they didn't just appear there. Like, they didn't just poof. All, you know, they went there.
Right.
You know, they went there to have influence. So it's like,
and they networked with each other. They promoted each other. And
it's
these
Jews, these New York intellectuals. These Jewish New York intellectuals are just influential because they're smart and in New York. Well, why are they smart in New York? You know, and then it's also like, if you acknowledge from an HBD perspective that there is this IQ advantage, some people say it's 10, some people say it's 5, some people say it's 15. I don't know what it is, but just say there's an IQ advantage. I believe that there is. It's been well documented. Why wouldn't they use this to their advantage?
Of course.
Like, it doesn't actually make sense that they wouldn't. You would have to take, you kind of have to go with HBD. And then you got to stop halfway and say, oh, yeah, sure, Jews, they're definitely smart people. But they're not using it to their advantage, which just doesn't make sense. So it's like we see that they've selected among themselves for like, I don't think they even object to your initial thesis, which Jews have selected amongst themselves for high IQ, and they've selected for ethnocentrism. Given these two, it doesn't even make sense They wouldn't wield these weapons of biological warfare, you could even say, to their advantage. Why wouldn't they? It doesn't make sense. Sure. What's the point of traits like that if you don't use them?
Exactly. And how can you explain something like the Israel lobby, you know?
Yeah.
Or the fact that, you know, Jewish values have always been to the liberal end. Going back to the 50s earlier, you know, in the diaspora, in the diaspora. But then when you go to Israel, things change dramatically. And there's just no consistent Jewish ethics or something like that. It's just not a universalist ethics. Never has been, and I don't think it ever will be.
Another criticism that Kaufman seems to make is when he talks about, say, you're talking about the New York intellectuals. He's like, oh, but look, a lot of these, I think he talks about, like, say, you take 10 of these influential intellectuals, like Norman Mailer and such, like these guys, right? And then he's like, oh, but they were sympathetic to the Palestinians. And Noam Chomsky is another one. And it's sort of like, okay, that's fine. But where, and the way I look at it, this is sort of this dialectic maintenance that they're doing. So you see, again, sure, there are going to be Jews in that intellectual movement that did express sympathy for Palestinians. And some of them even said, oh, the far right Israel parties are kind of modeled after a National Socialist Party. And they made these claims. And it's like, right, but notice how Jewish of a criticism that is, even of Israel. So clearly their Jewish identity is part of this. And I've also noticed, one of the things I've also noticed, and I don't know if you document this or not, but it's an interesting observation I made, being in New York and having been part of a pro-Palestine movement in my youth as a leftist, it was always headed up by Jews. And they seemingly were there to play a role of never letting it go into the realm of actual anti-Semitism. It seemed like that was part of their motivation. Because anybody that came in, because they were led by Jews, and there's Arabs in there and whites and some very few other ethnicities, mostly Arabs, Jews and whites, and occasionally some Latinos, never blacks. But you knew that was just off the table, that talking about Jews was off the table. You had to talk about the Israeli right only. And, you know, this is kind of branching far afield. But the point is that the fact that a Jew that is working for Jewish interests in terms of undermining a white cohesion, it's possible that for some consistency in their own mind, they'd also not be friendly to Israel. But again, that's not the focus of their work.
It's not the point. What I'm trying to say is, what I'm trying to put my finger on are certain powerful Jewish movements, the ones that have really had the influence. And in that case, the power of the peace movement, there's the Jewish Voice for Peace, and there's Mondawais and people like that who dissent from that. But they don't have the power now. They don't have the money.
Yeah.
And the other point to make about them is that they oftentimes see what they're doing as in Jewish interest.
Yes.
And that's fine. And in other words, I can easily imagine, because of what's happening on the left throughout the West now, is that the left is becoming disenchanted with Israel. They are saying, look, we got to tone this down.
Yeah.
Or we're not going to have any support. And you know, look at Mondawais, you know, Philip Weiss. He writes a lot of great stuff, very critical, very incisive against the Israel lobby. But you know, he's a proud Jew, and he sees it as, you know, this is not a viable strategy in the long run for Israel to do what they're doing, and he sees that young Jews are oftentimes defecting from a strong allegiance they've had to Israel. So yeah, you know, the fundamental point, and I made this back in 2002 in the preface of the paperback edition, first paperback edition, that what is going on here is that you can't ever think of the Jewish community as monolithic.
Right, yeah.
And you know, the example I have is Zionism in the early 20th century. This was not a mainstream movement. This was at the fringes of the Jewish community. But it was a Jewish movement.
Right,
and
yeah.
Everybody in it was Jewishly motivated. And eventually they triumphed. You know, so it's like, again, I think Kotz is a smart guy who's either blinded by his ethnic identity and allegiances, or he's just being obtuse, really. The arguments just keep repeating, and it's like, Didn't you read what I wrote?
Yeah, I am suspicious that there's some deliberate obfuscation going on here, because he seems to never address the point that Jews can be at odds with each other but working within an overall pro-Jewish framework.
Yeah,
which is so obvious.
Conceptualize Jewish interests in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, not every Jew has to think that all Jews should be X.
Yeah.
You know, that there's easily room. Jews can easily say, I'm a Jew, and I think Jewish interests are this. And right. I know Jews don't all agree with me on that, but, you know, so what?
Yeah, and I think the main issue is that, he loves to say, well, here's this left-wing Jew, and he'll either say, this Jew is so left-wing, they're out of sync with the mainstream Jewish community, which he thinks is a gotcha, or, oh, look, the guy that disagreed with this left-wing Jew was a right-wing Jew. And he did that with you with the Ehrlich thing. And I jumped right on that. I was like, yeah, but who's the guy opposing him? Julian Simon. What does Julian Simon stand for? Well, Julian Simon was a Cato Institute scholar and open borders fanatic. I mean, yeah. He was fanatically open borders. He did actually a debate with Peter Brimlow in the 90s, and he has an appearance where he was on Charlie Rose, where he's saying, like, look, not only is the population not going up too fast, it's not going up fast enough such that we need mass immigration. So here we have a dialectic between these two Jews, one of which is saying the environment's going to crap, we need to have people, particularly wealthy people, not having kids, which is something that is maintained with this global warming debate and such. So the population bomb, and look, Julian Simon did disprove Ehrlich. He did make points that were valid, totally valid points that disproved the theory. I'm not saying he didn't. He did. But his intellectual work was not only dedicated to saying, hey, look, you're wrong, white people should have children. No, he said, you're wrong, we need to bring in the third world because we're running out of people.
Right.
And so to me, this is a perfect example of what we call the kosher sandwich. That's kind of what we call this that's kind of what we call this phenomenon, where you get two Jews that are sort of dominating public discourse on a topic, and both sort of avenues you can go down serve a Jewish interest and don't really serve a white interest. So not having children doesn't serve a white interest. But then we have a guy opposing that who's not saying have children. It's fine to have children. You should have many children. But oh, no, we need to bring in the third world, which is also doesn't serve white interests. And both of those do serve Jewish interests. So, again, you know, I called Koffness on this right away. He never addressed it, of course, because he doesn't want to address these kind of criticisms. But he was saying that this was a gotcha on you. And I was like, no, far from it. Julian Simon fits right into this.
You know, I didn't see that tweet until much later because I had him muted, I guess. I didn't even realize that. I've unmuted him since. But the obvious, you know, problem, and I think that's a great point about Simon, that he was open borders fanatic.
Way out of line with
also
mainstream.
That, you know, I wasn't even making a claim about Ehrlich's Jewish identity.
No.
It's like, I can't talk about a Jew who's advocating this. Is that what how can you make that claim? And again, I'm trying to make strong claims in Culture of Critique. I you know, it would have been irresponsible, and I don't think I would have, I could have had, you know, I couldn't have certainly felt as good about it if I just said, well, there's a bunch of Jews here. You know, you've got to get into what they're thinking. And So the whole point, as I said before, about the chapter on Jews on the left is they identified as Jews, and they saw the Bolshevik Revolution as good for the Jews. And you can document that. It's not like it's a secret code or something. It's there in the writings and everything else. And of course, what the Jewish community has done is say, well, these weren't really Jews. They were, you know, not really part of the Jewish community or something like that. Why? Because they didn't go to synagogue. That's the only thing. They totally identified as Jews in every other way. They associated with other Jews. They promoted other Jews. And they were in these Jewish networks. And they saw themselves as advancing Jewish interests. When the Soviet Union came out against Israel, an awful lot of them defected.
Yeah. You know, fundamental misunderstanding of Jewish identity is thinking it's solely linked to religion. I think that is for some of them.
That's really stupid.
But it's, I mean, look, I, and this is a thing I've known my whole life. Like, I none of the Jews, I mean, not none, but almost none of the Jews I grew up with and went to high school with and such were in any way religious. They would sometimes moan about having to go to synagogue because it's Yom Kippur or something, and it's boring because you have to be there all day, and just some guy is chanting in Hebrew or something, and they don't care about it. But that doesn't make them any less very strongly Jewish identified. Right. And the thing I noticed even growing up in high school is that there were sort of friendship circles when we were littler kids, like when we were young, playgroups and such that would be Gentile and Jewish mixed. But as we got older, it seemingly naturally went that there was just a Jewish clique. And if you didn't notice it, you're just like, oh, yeah, that's the clique with those guys. Our clique was over here, happens to be Italian, Irish, and everything else. You know, like, I was from New Jersey, so heavily Italian, Irish. I was even somewhat of an oddity because I'm mostly Norwegian. So I was, you know, my parents identify very WASPy, very, you know, Episcopalian. So I was even made fun of for not being a Catholic, but we were still white. Like, it was definitely the cliques separated to a white and a Jewish group, but you had to kind of know it to realize that's what had happened.
You should write about that because, you know, there's the research on black-white interactions growing up, the developmental literature, shows that when kids are young, they'll integrate, they'll have friends and socialize much more across racial lines.
But that happened as well,
older,
too.
No, they don't. It separates, and you know, I think people become more aware of that, and I suspect it's a biological thing going on there, that there's some increase in.
I mean, I believe that there has been research. Correct me if I'm wrong. There has been research that you can look at a person's clique, their circle of friends, and that generally speaking, their closest friends will have genetic compatibility with them, even not lovers, but friends.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Phil Rushton's genetic similarity theory says exactly that. And it explains why people who get married tend to be more like each other in a variety of characteristics, where there's IQ or personality and interests and so on. But friends, they're actually, you know, just same-sex friends. And they take blood types and other genetic markers. They're more similar genetically than a cross-section of the population, even the same ethnic group.
Which would definitely account for this phenomena of as you grow older, you grow closer to those in your genetic in-group and further from those outside of it.
Absolutely.
And I would actually argue that in this case, this was a process that happened probably consciously for the Jewish kids, but less consciously for the Gentiles. Like, the Jewish kids knew they were self-segregating into a Jewish clique, while still maintaining friendships outside of it. Those friendships got cooler, more formal, less warm as, you know, as time went on, and the internal Jewish friendship became more and more important, and they probably knew that that's what they were doing. Whereas with the Gentiles, they're just like, oh yeah, we don't hang out with those guys anymore. Like, whatever happened to those guys? They don't come over anymore. And, you know, but here we are, where we just happen to all be Italian, Irish, white guys just hanging out, and these Jewish guys don't come over anymore. And that did absolutely happen. So
you should write about that. I mean, and one thing I noticed, even at a sort of longer trajectory, is that it's quite common for Jews who really don't express much in-group loyalty. But as they get older, really older, not talking about teenage years, I'm talking about, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, they get more intensely ethnocentric, and they become sort of more committed to their Jewish identity as they get older. So there are quite a number of cases. I've footnoted a couple of my books, just examples of this. And I think it's probably quite common. And you see this in the Jewish press. You know, there'll be somebody who finally at age 70 decides to get a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah or something. So that's the idea that suddenly that this Jewish identity really comes to
the fore. That's also sort of what happened kind of to neoconservatives is sort of as a movement. Now, I think that was informed by other things, like the 1967 war in Israel, I think, was part of this.
But
certainly after the 67 war in Israel, you saw a lot of these, you know, like it's well documented. You document it yourself, the neoconservative movement, like the Crystals, Pod Horetzes, etc. They suddenly became hyper Zionist, where they had been like leftist and communist before, and David Horowitz is another one, And then after the 67 war, they're like, oh, now I am pro-America all the way. And it's like, okay, like pro-America, pro-Israel all the way. They became Zionists. And then you also see playwright David Mamet, who actually wrote Glengarry Glen Ross, which is one of my favorite movies. He was kind of a left liberal guy. But then after 9/11, you know, sometimes maybe some of this, these conversions, if you will, are informed by events like this. After 9/11, he becomes a neocon. And he starts
You know, but there are also contextual influences on Jewish identity, like the 1967 war. I have a quote, I think it's a Cultural Critique, where the guy says, I didn't know how Jewish I was till this happened. And suddenly he started donating Jewish causes and joining Jewish organizations and, you know, getting all gung-ho. And that's why I think, even now, where the Jewish organizations are constantly flogging the idea that anti-Semitism is, you know, on the rise and we have to watch out for all, even now, the Jewish community is only very slightly mobilized. I mean, if it really got intense, you wouldn't believe what would happen. I mean, if there really was someone who was talking, you know, in a strongly anti-Jewish way, becoming a prominent politician, running for president in a credible way, wow, you wouldn't, all the stops would be pulled out.
Well, I mean,
massive amounts of money, massive media propaganda, and you wouldn't ever.
Last time this happened, two empires were mobilized, right? I mean, the two biggest empires on earth were mobilized the last time this happened in a country. So,
Exactly.
I mean, that was a conscious.
Far left, and then the capitalist West.
I mean, you had communists and capitalists, both countries with heavy Jewish control over the goings on in those countries. Yeah. Went after Germany when, you know, a guy rose up and was openly anti-Semitic and openly said the Jews are the problem. And boom, wow, they were smashed between two, you know, and that's what happened. And so, it is a little bit frightening almost to wonder what would happen. But then there's also the issue that for our own interests, we have to, and I don't believe we have to do, like, and one of the things they want to associate white activism with what I believe is a caricature of what National Socialism was about, but it's a powerful caricature. And I think that this is a powerful weapon in their toolbox is to associate white activism with these things that have been made taboo, things like Nazis and the KKK, and they want to make you think, hey, if you're pro-white in any way, you're just a terrible person because it's going to end in genocide. And I think there's really stupid people that sometimes themselves associate white activism with things like violence against non-whites and genocide, and that's just really dumb. You shouldn't do that. Which I do think a critique of the historical narrative surrounding World War II is in order, but associating your own interests with being just like a psychopath is really stupid, I think. Like Brenton Tarrant type stuff. I've been critical of that attack that he did. I don't think it was helpful, and I've gotten some pushback from people, but I'm saying, like, look, it's just not, you don't want to associate yourself with that. It's just very bad.
I've had to really walk a lot of thin lines.
Well, I also think, though, that it the enemy wants to portray us that way. Like, they would like us to be that way. And the other thing is, you can understand why Brenton Tarrant did what he did. I mean, he told us why he did what he did. And I think on some level, the way that they are proceeding with censorship is going to make such outbursts inevitable in a way, which is not to condone them. You know, one of the things when analyzing terrorism against the United States, people would say, well, I don't condone it, but given all these things that are going on, Muslim anger directed at the United States is understandable. And I think that's an approach that kind of was on the table. People were allowed to say that in the debate. A lot of the people saying that were Jews themselves. But you can't – that is off the table when it comes to things like Brenton Tarrant, right? The Christchurch shooter, where one can say, I understand why he did it, but I don't condone it. And I think that that's a perspective that has to be out there, because otherwise we won't there's just deliberate obfuscation and nobody gets a clear picture of what's going on. So I do think that this is a response to, one, what's going on, and two, the absolute inability to talk about it. Like, we are facing we are up against a demographic wall. We haven't noticed it yet because certain events that are going to happen in the future, which will happen, haven't happened yet, like the baby boom generation dying off. This will leave the white population of the world much lower than it was before. And as we've lost political power and political influence, we're going to be in a bad spot. And the most alarming example of whites being in a bad spot would be South Africa. I don't think the United States will become like that, at least not for a very long time. But it is an example of where white people could be headed if we don't
start doing something. A long-term point of view, 100 years, 500 years, and saying what are the trends here? And
I mean, it's possible the United States could be like a South Africa in 200 years or 100 years even.
And I think but one thing that's happening is that we see more and more anti-white hate in the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And it's just almost no holds barred now.
Yeah.
And you see it, Huffington Post and the New York Times hiring that Asian woman, Jiang, and other people who have a history of this. And you see all these Twitter accounts who are virulently anti-white. They don't get censored. And people compile those things. And whites hear that. They see that more and more.
Mm-hmm.
That triggers ethnocentrism. So I think that they are playing with some very dangerous things. And when white people are told that they're going to be a minority, they are angry. They're not happy about this because I think they understand when you're a minority, you lack political power. When you lack political power, you can't protect yourself as well.
No.
It's a problem. Nobody would want to be a minority. Wouldn't you always want to be a majority of whatever group, society you're in? You just don't want to go there.
Yeah, and I mean, you have said that whites in these coming years might adopt different kinds of survival strategies, some of them that might even be analogous to Jewish strategies in the future. Do you want to talk about that for a second? Like what? Because I do think that, as you said, the anti-whiteness triggers white ethnocentrism, and a similar thing happens to Jews. The difference being, of course, their ethnocentrism is not socially prescribed. But it seems like it's a natural process that would happen in any person. when their group's or seems to be under attack, they're going to become more ethnocentric. And so whites aren't exempt from it. But why then should we have to suffer under a system where our ethnocentrism is the only thing that is censored and prescribed from public debate? That's intolerable, and it can't continue, I would argue.
And they will continue that as long as they can to pathologize. I remember way back in I guess it was like 10, 15 years ago when I was debating colleagues at my university on email lists. I say stuff like, well, when would it be okay for whites to identify as whites? When they're 40%, 30%, 10%? Nobody would want to answer that one.
Yeah. And
because, there's an obvious problem there. When you are a minority and when you think you're becoming a minority, you identify more and you start to have more of an in-group, out-group perspective. So I think that our psychology, is complicated, and the fact that we are more agreeable, warmer, nicer people on average than other groups is a problem. I think that all that's going to be overcome in the long run. There's an interesting article on Occidental Observer just a little while ago on Latin American politics. And it was basically presenting the idea that in Latin America, whites are a minority, but they're a tough minority.
Mm-hmm.
And that will happen again. It's not like that we're incapable of that. And they're tough, and they do what needs to be done. This is an article by Racial Politics in Latin America by Patrick Berman. It's a very interesting article. And the guy's also written for American Renaissance.
I remember the article. Now, it's one thing about Latin America is that people might not always know is that the Jews do have power down there as well.
There's
a number of very wealthy oligarchical Jewish families that do network with other Jews, pro-Israel and such. I mean, Bolsonaro, a lot of people liked Bolsonaro's election because he was promising to be tough on crime and all this stuff. Now, Brazil, obviously never going to be a white state. It's one of the most racially diverse states on earth. But he's taking a very pro-Zionist line along with all of that. So he's sort of fitting into a kind of a neocon type figure. But in any case, I mean, that's not really all that relevant to what we're talking about here. But no, I do agree. I think white people are becoming, we are seeing it already. I mean, the sort of alt-right and or whatever other right-wing dissident movements you want to see. And it's had an effect. We have had an effect. So, you know, talking about the lobby, how much these Israel lobbyists were worried about the decline of support for Israel on the left. Well, that's starting to happen on the right, too. There has been a recent poll that shows that the support for Israel amongst Republicans has fallen in recent years as well. That's gonna be another phenomenon that's gonna send the Jewish interests into a big panic, because they're gonna be like, "Well, look," and you know, they I've heard Jews themselves say, "Look, if we see anti-Semitism on the left from these pro-Palestine groups, so, that's a different animal than it coming from right-wing whites." They're like right-wing anti-Semitism is a much more threatening prospect to us than left-wing. Because left-wing, well, they'll whine, oh, you're being unfair, and it sucks. But they're not making any real progress with that. Israel still is ascendant, and it's still carrying out these policies. It's like, at best, it's an inconvenience to them, although it's one that they want to solve with straight-up censorship, like this Florida law you've been talking about, which is just outrageous and should be struck down immediately.
It should be.
Yeah. But yeah, we've gone about 2 hours and 15 minutes now. I'm sure you might be getting a little bit tired.
Yeah, I should get going, really.
But this was a great conversation. Thanks for...
We can do it again.
We should do it again. I think this is fantastic.
Simulated conversation, actually.
I think this is a fantastic conversation. Just real quick...
You are well-read on this issue, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah. No, it's been... Ever since I read your book in 2014, and then I met you for the first time in 2015. I don't know if you recall, at the MPI conference in Washington. And I attended another. We attended another event together, very small, but it was right before. It was when Trump was still running, and you made the prediction of exactly what we're seeing today. Should Trump win, which was that the TV screens would be filled with these crying Latino children and such. If we started to try and deport immigrants, and of course, it wasn't a tough prediction to make, but you know, it all came true. And at that time, we were very nervous. We didn't think Trump was going to win. We're like,
I never thought he'd win. Yeah,
we weren't even sure he was going to win the nomination. It was a very big upset and a very big surprise, and gave a lot of people hope. And I think it should.
Me included.
I think it should continue to give people hope, because it shows that there's still a fighting spirit, even if we didn't get everything we wanted. I think we got a lot of mileage.
A hostile takeover of the Republican Party against the entire establishment, left, right, center, and you know they're never going to forgive him.
And they've had to, and it's not just him; they're not going to forgive. It's the voters, and they've had to. Yeah.
Absolutely. They hate the Republican voters,
and they have had to reorient their strategy, and they've had to account for this rise in sort of nationalistic and crypto ethnocentric feeling among whites, and it's changed the political landscape. And we have gotten a lot of mileage out of it. We haven't gotten policy, but we've gotten a lot of metapolitical mileage out of it, and ultimately, the will result in policy changes. So that's the approach I take. So yeah,
if revolution is not possible with nonviolent ways, it ultimately will be.
Yeah, well, politics is always going to be involved some amount of violence. I mean, the state is a violent entity. A takeover of the state would revolt. I don't advocate violence, but I do.
Yeah, we can't be afraid of it, though. We have to realize that the sort of democratic solutions, we're running out of them.
Yeah,
quickly.
And it's the main thing is that fundamentally, the government and statism and the use of the state resources involves the use of force. And so if those are going to be used against us, or if we want to take them over and use them in our interest, there's nothing wrong with the people using a state and the resources of a state in their interest. That's what nationalism is about. There is force and projection of force involved in that. I don't advocate vigilante violence. That's always just stupid. But like, you know, taking over the state involves the use of force, and we can't shy away from it. We can't be these anarchist weirdo types. But yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think it was a great conversation. Thanks all for coming on. We should do it again. Again, everybody go out and buy Kevin's books from Barnes & Noble or from the publisher. Support his work, and we'll be eagerly looking forward to your next book when it comes out.
Great.
All right. So thank you, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye.
See you.
Always give your best. Never get discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember. Others may be.
Those who hate you don't hate you unless you hate them. Then you destroy yourself.